was yesterday. I just kind of...
So if you put it opposed to alternative things.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment to order. And I'm going to turn it over to the committee administrator briefly to give us a little housekeeping about the recording system.
Representative Holby and committee members, just two brief housekeeping things. We have a new recording system for the audience. It should, and for the members, a lot easier to be able to, you can watch the hearings back on the website. So I think it's going to be a great thing for us. But just to be aware that there is a slight delay when we're turning on the system. And then whenever that blue light is on, it means the mics are on. And when he adjourns the meeting, sometimes there's a slight delay after that, too. So just be aware that the mics are still live when the blue light is on. Also, in front of you is an example of a background brief that Committee Services updates every 2 years. And those are available on our website. It's just... covers a lot of different issues, and it can be helpful in your offices as well as personal staff or for the general public.
Great, thank you. So, committee, today we have a couple of topics. We wanted to have our overview of water quality and then renewable energies and some grid issues in relationship to renewable energy. It's a pretty full agenda, and I really wanted to get a good overview presentation from a wide range of experts in these fields. And so I'm hoping that we're able to hold our questions and write down your questions, because if we get into too many questions and opining, we won't get through the agenda, and I really do want to hear from the presenters on these two issues. So keep that in mind. If we can't get to questions, we're going to be watching the time pretty closely. Write your questions down. You may have heard this in other committees, and get it to the committee administrator. And we can follow up with those questions as a committee, or you can follow up individually, as you know, as well. So from that point of view, I'd like to go ahead and get started. We have opened it up, so I'm going to open up an informational meeting on water quality. And first up, I'd like to have the Department of Environmental Quality representatives, Palmer Mason and Jennifer Weigel. Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for being here bright and early.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me today Jennifer Weigel. She is the Water Quality Program Manager for the department. You've asked us to come and provide a 101 on the Clean Water Act, as well as the state programs that DEQ runs, and that's what we'll do. It's a lot of material to cover, but we'll do our best to fit it all in. I do want to mention there are other agencies that do have water quality responsibilities, so this is a presentation from the perspective of the Department of Environmental Quality. I know Oregon Health Authority is here to talk about some of their responsibilities, but I did want to acknowledge that we're providing a presentation about our role. And with that, I guess we can start.
Good morning, and again for the record, my name is Jennifer Weigel. And so today I'm going to cover, as Palmer said, I'm going to cover a number of things related to the water quality programs that DEQ administers, cover a little bit about whether those programs are largely federal in origin or have a state component, and also hit on some overview of water quality status and trends information, some of the current issues that we're focused on and see as being things for us to work on in the near future. So with that, I'm going to start with this particular overview. And some of you, if you're familiar with the water program, you may have seen this before. We sometimes call this the water wheel. But really what it is it's just describing the interconnectedness of the programs that DEQ administers. And so starting in the middle, really what we're talking about is establishing standards and goals for our water bodies. And that moves to collecting information, monitoring information, assessing against that information. And then what we do with that information is we establish strategies intended to hit our goals. A large part of what we do is permitting and authorizing activities to and ensuring that we assist businesses and individuals in their obligations to meet environmental requirements. We have a compliance function and enforcement where needed. And ultimately, you know, we work all of these programs and all these activities have a strong connection from one to the other, and ultimately are focused around trying to meet the objectives that we set. You're going to see this. I'm going to use this diagram a couple more times just to begin to highlight, because this is really, I think, the water program itself, all the different activities that we carry out are very interconnected, and are what we do in one area has a direct effect on what we do in our other programs. So I'm going to use this a couple times to kind of organize how I talk about the different programs that DEQ administers. First, I want to elaborate a little bit about some of the different areas in which DEQ develops strategies to meet its environmental goals. There's a number of different areas in which we work. Groundwater is one important area, and our particular piece of source water protection, that's where our intersection to drinking water is. OHA has the primary authority for regulating drinking water sources and the delivery of drinking water, where DEQ comes in as the protection of the source water itself, whether it's groundwater or surface water. Non-point source, again, it's another strategy where we have a role, but really, the primary authority for administering non-point source controls, a large part of that resides with Department of Agriculture and Department of Forestry. We take on a supporting role, establishing what the goals and targets are, but they have the primary role for those regulated entities. And there's also a local community side of this as well, and I'll get into that a little bit more when I talk about our different programs. Clean water plans or total maximum daily loads is another name by which that's known. But, you know, what are the strategies that we put in place when we know we're not meeting our standards and we know that action needs to be taken? And how do we work toward achieving those goals we have for the waters? And permitting and certification is another really large area of our water quality program. And I'll talk in more detail about that. And at the bottom there, I just wanted to highlight that we do, as part of operating these programs, we do offer grants and loans, primarily for water quality purposes. Our grants are largely under our non-point source focused grants under the federal monies we receive from EPA. And we also operate a state revolving fund loan program, which historically has been targeted at wastewater treatment infrastructure. But really, the trend in that is looking into the future a little bit more broadly about that than just the gray infrastructure part of things. So moving on, one of the things that we'd been asked to talk about here today was the kind of the Clean Water Act and how that relates to the work that we do. I wanted to start off a little just with some basics about the Clean Water Act. One thing about it, it was obviously a federal statute. It was adopted in the early 70s. Not a whole lot of revisions have actually happened to that statute since 1972. So when I talk about some of our current challenges and things in our program, some of those things can be traced back to the fact that it's not seen a major overhaul since that time. And as you can see, it had some fairly ambitious goals established in that act. So the first one, you know, kind of a general one, restore and maintain the quality of the nation's waters, focusing on the chemical, physical, and biological integrity. And then there's these next two that were a little more specific, that we are to attain fishable and swimmable waters by 1983. And this one, I think, probably arguably the most ambitious of all, zero discharge of pollutants by 1985. Don't think we're quite there, but it remains in statute. One of the things about the Clean Water Act that it did, prior to being established in 1972, states across the country had a whole variety of water quality programs that they were operating. At that time, Oregon was probably one of the most progressive. We actually had our own permitting program prior to the Clean Water Act being adopted in 1972. But there was a wide variety of regulations and approaches that states were taking. So arguably, there was some economic disadvantages and advantages for industries that were making choices about where to site in the country. And people were just doing things a lot differently. And there were some, of course, very serious and public environmental disasters that occurred in the late 60s that really prompted the whole suite of environmental statutes that were adopted in the early 70s. But some of the things that the Clean Water Act did was it really established basic program requirements for states across the country. And also what it did was it established a level playing field across industrial sectors. So if there was a pulp and paper plant or a metal finisher operating anywhere in the country, they established technological minimums so that there was a kind of a floor and a kind of a baseline equal playing field across those across industrial sectors. It also established a national permit program for dischargers. And that particular program, there were parts of the Clean Water Act and the programs that they established where states could elect to run those programs, and other parts of the Clean Water Act where states had no choice but to administer those programs. So permitting is one of those programs where states could choose to pursue administration of those programs. And in the last bullet here, the Clean Water Act directly requires states to administer water quality standards and to set those. One other thing I'd like to note about the Clean Water Act, and another big part of what it did in 1972, was to establish a construction grants program. So a lot of the wastewater treatment plants that are in existence today were the beneficiaries of a large influx of grant monies that went to those communities to build those treatment plants in the late 70s and early 80s. And when I get to the current issues part of my presentation, I'll highlight kind of where that's left us today. So again, back to this. So what I'm going to do in the next few slides is just kind of talk about these different components as it relates to the Clean Water Act and the activities that DEQ does more specifically. And I'll highlight which parts of those pieces are really driven by the federal law and which pieces we've either built upon it or expanded upon it under state law. So first, starting with water quality standards. A couple things that just to take away in terms of what water quality standards are. This is a Clean Water Act program we're required to administer. And there's two basic components to that. One is, what is the goal and the use for the water bodies? So for the Willamette River, happy, healthy fish, recreation. It's a source of drinking water. So what are those things that it should be protected for? And then we establish what we call criteria, which are really, most of the time, what that represents is pollutant concentrations that shouldn't be exceeded in order to ensure it can be used for all those purposes. So for recreation, for example, we want people to be able to swim and boat and canoe and kayak. And in order to protect that, we establish levels of bacteria that shouldn't be exceeded in order to ensure that those activities can safely occur. With regard to monitoring, there is a Clean Water Act component, and of course there's lots of other components we do in terms of monitoring. Again, the takeaway here with regard to monitoring is really the things that monitoring produce for us is they give us data about what's going on in a water body. And we need to be able to pull that data into our programs, turn it into information, and use it to be able to make decisions about whether or not we are operating those programs efficiently and effectively. Are we meeting our goals? Understanding whether or not our facilities are in compliance. Understanding what is, how are we doing in terms of water quality? How are we doing not just today, but over time? So there's a number of different ways we use monitoring. A lot of the purposes for which we use monitoring are Clean Water Act based, but we also use a lot of monitoring to help support other programs that we've established under state law. And I will talk a little bit more later in the presentation about some of the high-level status and trends and information that we get related to the monitoring data that we collect and others collect. One of the major uses that I would like to highlight, which is also a Clean Water Act requirement, is an obligation for all states to do every 2 years a statewide assessment of all available water quality data and information. So this is it's a pretty big thing. We have a lot of water quality data and information, and we have a lot of miles of streams and rivers. We're required to do this every couple of years and compare this to the water quality standards to give us an indication of how we're doing. Three things that when we do this assessment that we produce, we as a result of producing this, we're required to identify which waters are attaining standards, which waters are threatened. We have the data is not conclusive one way or the other, but or the trends over time are indicating that they're declining. And we're also, and some of you may be familiar with this last requirement, is we are required to identify waters that are not attaining standards and are therefore impaired. This is sometimes referred to as the 303D list, which is the section of the statute that establishes this requirement. We also do other kinds of assessments that give us broad kinds of information or water body specific information. We've done large reports on the Willamette River. We've done it in other parts of the state that give us a more targeted insight on particular water bodies and maybe answering specific project specific questions as well. So another piece of this is the establishing the clean water plans. And so again, some people may know this as TMDLs. Total maximum daily loads is the long version of how you describe this. But what I've attempted to lay out here is just that the establishment of total maximum daily loads is really a process. Where that process begins is when we have a water body identified as being impaired or not attaining standards. So we usually approach the development of these on a priority basis. We try to establish, because we can't do all these at once, it's a lot of modeling, it's a lot of data analysis, and usually before we get started, we do additional data collection. But when we approach these, we start with, the first thing we need to start with is identifying, so what's going on in the basin? If it's impaired for, say, bacteria, what are the different sources that may be contributing sources of bacteria within the basin? We will do modeling, we'll do other kinds of analysis, and try to figure out, so how much is coming from where today? We'll also do some additional modeling to say, well, what is the total load of that pollutant that can be put into that water body and still meet standards? So we'll do that assessment. We'll say, well, how much total can be put in? How does that relate to what's being put in today? And then we'll be the next piece is then we've got to allocate pieces of that pie. So people right now may be helping themselves more to a larger share of pie than what they can. So we need to cut back on those slices of pie. And this is the really challenging part. This is the piece here where it says allocate waste loads among sources. Our approach to this is we convene what are called local advisory committees in this process so that we can get as much insight as possible about what's going on and what's possible given the different sources of those loads within a watershed. After we allocate loads, that's part of what goes into the TMDL. Then we have a number of implementing mechanisms. One of the main ways in which we implement is through the issuance of permits. Another way in which we implement them is through non-point source programs. In this instance, in the example I'm highlighting here for bacteria, some of the main implementers in this case may be the Departments of Agriculture in terms of their interaction with landowners. It may also be local communities. There's a number of different ways. By and large, implementation of non-point source is something where we have to work very closely with those implementers to be able to be clear about here's what's coming out of the TMDL. We need to understand what's possible, and typically how that then would work is those entities are then responsible for coming up with an implementation plan that describes how they will intend to go about reducing their pollution. Permitting, I just want to spend a minute on this as well. This is a large part of what we do. A couple of statistics. Our permits cover over 8,000 facilities or activities. I say facilities or activities because sometimes we cover an activity as a sector. Sometimes facilities actually receive more than one permit from us. There's two pieces to this program. One is the federal program. So the federal program, we write National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDS permits, and that universe is around 5,000. We cover about 5,000 facilities or entities through our federal permit program. Those are for discharges to surface water. And so if somebody has a pipe, it's going into a surface water, they get a permit from us. That's kind of the easiest way to think about it. We also issue state permits, water pollution control facility permits, and those are for non non-discharging facilities. So a number of municipal wastewater treatment plants in eastern Oregon, for example, do not discharge to surface waters. They may land apply, they may use it for irrigation, but it's not going back to a river. And so we would issue them a state permit, a WPCF permit for those. And we cover around 3,000 entities under that program. Couple of things just to highlight what the range of things are that we permit. Municipal wastewater is a large part of what we permit. We issue somewhere in the neighborhood of about 300 permits to communities for municipal wastewater discharges. We also cover industrial wastewater. There's a number of sectors that we cover there, everything from paper mills to food processors, metal finishers. It's a wide range of industrial activities that we cover under that. Another large sector that's grown over the last 20 years is stormwater. We issue permits to cities, construction sites to control erosion on site and runoff, as well as to industrial sites that may have, when they have rainwater falling onto
their operations.
There can be things that some metal, frequently metals and things like that, can get into their stormwater and run off into our waters. What we are seeing in terms of permitting is that the universe is expanding. As I mentioned, stormwater, historically in the early 90s, we had virtually no permits for stormwater. Now we issue in the neighborhood of around 20 individual permits for cities, for larger cities and their stormwater programs, and we cover between 3,000 and 4,000 entities under the construction and industrial stormwater programs. So it's a sector that's growing and is, and just because of the size, is challenging for us to keep up with resource-wise. And permits are definitely getting more complex. We've got a number of stringent requirements in our state, temperature and toxic pollutants, and incorporating an evaluation against all of those permits into our, for our permittees, is increasing that complexity. We also have a lot of third-party scrutiny on how we conduct our programs, and a lot of times that manifests itself in the permit issuance process. The on-site septic system, this is a program that is wholly under state law as opposed to federal law. The first three bullets there are things that we do across the state, so licensing pumpers and installers and approving products that can be used in septic systems. The bottom two, tasks that we do, siting and permitting and complaint response and enforcement, we do those activities in the counties where we are the implementers of the program. We implement the program in 10 counties, and this is a map here of the counties in which we operate. The on-site program is in blue, and in the green counties, those are counties where the counties themselves operate the on-site system. So we just perform the oversight and the certification and those types of activities in those programs. In terms of groundwater protection, this is another area where DEQ acts, and it's mostly under state law. There is, as I mentioned earlier, we do have pieces in terms of, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, protection of those drinking water sources. So there's a connection here to groundwater, because groundwater is a significant source of drinking water in the state. And so our nexus for DEQ is in the protection of those groundwater resources. But largely a lot of the activities that we carry out are under the state Groundwater Protection Act. We work with local communities. We do monitoring, and we also work with local communities to protect groundwater resources. So with that, I wanted to, that covers a lot of the different kinds of state activities. This next slide here, talking about the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership, is both an illustration of a program that we administer under our own authorities that's voluntary based, and also an illustration of how our monitoring data comes into play. For those that are aware of the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership, it is a state program. It's innovative, it's non-regulatory, and is really has the success that it's seen has really been built on those great partnerships we have. Key partners for this project include OSU Extension, Department of Agriculture, grower groups, and local growers themselves. And this is a really good example of kind of targeted monitoring to understand what's going on with actions. And what we do, these are the basins in which we currently operate the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program. We received additional funding in the last session, and so we were able to expand the counties in which we're operating. And we go in with the grower groups. We collect data for currently used pesticides and establish a baseline. And then we work with the extension and the local grower groups and ODA to establish, to work with them on using pesticides most effectively, both for their crops and to ensure that it doesn't get into the surface waters. And we've seen, here's an example here, and this is just 3 years' worth of data. We've seen dramatic results as a result of these efforts. This is for malathione. As you can see, what we're shooting for here is actually based on our water quality standards. That's that black line at the bottom. When we started the project and did our baselining, we exceeded that criterion by several times. But through the implementation of practices, we were able to reduce those levels in those watersheds well below the criteria level. And still, it's not about getting rid of pesticides, but it's about using them better and more effectively.
Stuart?
We're holding questions. Thank you.
Well, I'm just trying to see how much is that 0.1 UG
per liter? Micrograms per liter.
Micrograms per liter. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was reading that right.
So, and here, this is, in terms of monitoring, this just depicts where we do routine monitoring around the state. We call this our ambient water quality network. We go to each one of these sites annually. We collect a handful of pollutant parameters and to get a high-level indication of status and trends. We've been going to these sites as far back as the 1950s. Typically, what we do, particularly with this network and the data that's collected here is, we pull that data together and we produce an index. We call it the Water Quality Index, and we use it to report on how things are doing over time at kind of at a high level to give us some indication of improving or decreasing trends. I'm going to highlight this next slide just to show you what this data looks like. And these are things that we report out in our KPMs biannually. But this first, you can see that this is dating back to 1990 through 2013. These bar graph charts show you the percent of waters, or the percent of sites showing an improving trend. So you can see that back in the late 90s and early 2000s, lots of waters were showing improving trends. And because this is an improving trend, really what this tells us is there was lots of waters in need of improvement back at that point in time. So there were large gains that were available to be made. What you'll see in this next slide is the number of waters showing decreasing trends. Obviously, we want to keep that number as low as possible, because once we've attained a certain level of water quality, we don't want to have slippage in that water quality. And lastly, kind of the summation of this is, and this is what we want to see this line at least moving up. These are the percent of waters that are in good or excellent condition. So you can see by and large, and it does track some of the bar charts below, is that by and large, we're maintaining fairly consistent, based on this index, fairly stable percent of waters that are in good or excellent condition. We are seeing very few waters these days that are declining in water quality. And at the same time, we're seeing around 20% of water showing improving trends. So the variability in terms of what's happening with our water quality is definitely declining. That said, there's still a lot of opportunities to make improvements in water quality around the state. Lastly, I just want to highlight a few things in terms of current issues and concerns, and I wanted to start off a little bit with small community needs. As I stated in the beginning, one of the major things that the Clean Water Act did when it was enacted was it provided a large influx of money and grants to communities to be able to build wastewater treatment plants. The useful life of a lot of those plants are around 30 years. And so now people built these nice wastewater treatment plants, and now they're nearing their end of their useful life. And the only thing that we have left at this point as a state to really offer them is we do have a state revolving loan fund program, which offers them very low interest loans, but it's still a loan. That money still does need to be repaid back. And even, as we know, if you borrow money and If you can't, if you don't have the resources to pay it back, you don't have the resources to pay it back. So that's still a limitation for a number of communities with their aging wastewater treatment plant infrastructure and no loans can be helpful in some cases, but there's no readily available pot of money to be able to grant to these communities to be able to do some of the needed infrastructure improvements that they need. In addition, technical assistance, you know, even just finding individuals who are capable of operating a wastewater treatment plant in some of these locations can be a challenge. Often these folks are asked to do more than one job. And so even just having the technical capabilities to be able to run, operate, plan, and deal with some of the complex issues, water quality issues that we have today can be a real challenge. DEQ does offer some level of technical assistance, but there is a large gap between what those community needs and what we are able to provide through our agency. The on-site problem, if you recall the map I showed you, there are some challenges with the existing business model. Largely the areas of the state where we directly administer the program are largely in rural areas of the state. So just the resources needed to administer from centralized offices a large area that's sparsely populated, the resource to community needs ratio is fairly high just because of the rural population. Most of the populous counties are administering their own programs, and so we've been looking into different ways about how can we improve that business model to make it all in all wholly more efficient program within DEQ and for the counties to really administer an effective on-site program. The wastewater permitting program, I mentioned that, you know, over time that permit universe is increasing. It is getting incredibly more complex and is often the frequent subject of litigation in state and federal courts. And so for us, keeping up both with those challenges when things get pulled into limbo during litigation continues to be challenging for us. And as I said, you know, federal litigation is one piece in terms of the permitting program, but also across all of our programs. We've had frequent litigation on our water quality standards. We currently have litigation on our temperature total maximum daily loads. And we also are continuing to feel the effects of litigation on our coastal zone non-point source management program. In terms of the coastal zone management program, the implications of that, which will be we expect to be played out in early 2015, could result in a significant reduction of our non-point source grant money that we receive from EPA if they disapprove aspects of our program. So there's some significant implications there, and for us to continue to work through those, both with EPA and the litigants in each of those cases, both it's a fairly complex field to navigate, and also just trying to work through and hopefully ending up with some working toward reasonable outcomes in that litigation continues to be a challenge for the agency. And lastly, just I think a lot of these things I've already alluded to a little bit, but for the water quality program, we have approximately 50% of our budget that's comprised of fees. We also have some federal funds. Federal funds have been either slightly declining or flat, so their purchasing power hasn't been as much as it has been historically. And fee revenue has, again, not been keeping up with everything else either. And so for us, just continuing to focus on the demands that we have in the program with our existing pool of resources, and how do we continue to try to make our program operations as efficient as we can, recognizing that some of these funding sources are changing or at least remaining relatively flat over time. And lastly, I just want to highlight a few things in terms of things that we are currently focused on. The first is what we are calling tracking, measuring, and reporting. One of the things that, especially as our Clean Water Act programs mature over time, we've been very successful, I think, at doing watershed plans and thinking about those things. But the thing that we haven't been able to do well is thinking about how do we communicate the success that we have had with those programs. We frequently find ourselves in a place where some people will say, well, nothing's happening. And we'll say, well, yes, it is happening. Well, no, it's not. Yes, it is. And figuring out, especially when we're dealing with pollutants like temperature and nutrients or bacteria even, some of the efforts on the ground take a long time before we are going to see significant water quality improvements. And so when we just go out and collect our monitoring data, that may not be enough to tell the whole story. There may be other things that we need to bring into the picture to be able to more fully describe and the successes and the good work that is happening by local landowners and permittees and things like that. So thinking about how do we communicate that better? Is it, can we talk more about dollars spent? Can we talk more about projects completed? Can we talk more about, in the case of temperature, increased shade, even though the trees in the riparian area may not be fully mature? There are things that we can begin to talk about and be consistent amongst the state agencies who also have a hand in doing this kind of restoration work. Can we be more both consistent across state agencies, but also be better at telling the story and taking credit for the good work that has happened over time? So that's one thing we're working on with other state agencies. Permitting continues to be a significant challenge for us. We are working on doing advancing our water quality trading program, where we can leverage permittees to help fund other more cost-effective improvements in the watershed. So sometimes just engineering our way out of the way is not going to be the best solution. Can we take that same money or even less money and do more good in the watershed? And that's what water quality trading will help us do. We're working on putting in place better strategies to be able to do that where the fact set supports those kinds of things. And also just for both permitting, and which also relates to this last bullet in terms of data management. In the permitting world, we have a number of systems that help us report to EPA, that help us know which permits we're issuing. As I've mentioned, we cover around 8,000 entities. They pay us fees. Being able to invoice them, know who we issue permits to, know what pollutants are covered, are they in compliance, have we done enforcement action, what's their water quality data information they're submitting to us. Our permitting systems are somewhat antiquated in our ability to be able to keep up with all this data and information and be able to convey that both to EPA and to the public. And also just generally with data management, as I mentioned, we have a requirement, and I think DEQ has a unique responsibility to be able to convey water quality information to the public. We have collected a lot of water quality data. A lot of other people out there have collected a lot of water quality data. Millions and millions of data points, and how do we make meaningful information from all of that? It's a significant data management challenge that is kind of front and center for us in the short term. So with that, I'll conclude, and hopefully we have 2 times limit for questions.
If I could, I wanted to add one more thing. Going back to that first bullet about tracking and reporting on results, not only is that important to sort of tell the story in a more complete way, but I think that will help us answer the question, are we making the right investments, and what are we seeing with those investments, what kind of return on the limited dollars that we're spending. So by, again, tracking and reporting better, I think we can answer those questions more completely.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. If you need some water, I'm sure one of us can give you some water.
Do I have a volunteer?
No, I can. Point source qualified.
Yeah. Yeah, get her some water. Yeah. Could tell you were running out of.
Is it permitted? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Hopefully that's quality water. Really appreciate it. I know I've got a list of, 10 questions, and I'm sure others do too, but we do want to move on, and as I mentioned before, we'll get to questions that we can submit to our committee administrator.
I have a question about the questions. Can we just submit all of our questions to you or the administrator then?
To the administrator, if you wish. Yeah, that would be an easy way to compile some of the questions, and we'll get a chance to then distribute those to the committee, was my hope, with the questions and the answers. If you want to do them individually, you're more than welcome to do that, too.
You don't want questions now?
Hmm. Okay. Otherwise, we won't get through all the presentations, so that's I apologize for that.
You will be punished.
Yes, later. I'm sure. So thank you very much for that presentation. Up next, I'd like to have the Oregon Health Authority, David Leland and Curtis.
So, like
Curtis Coote.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Dave Leland. I'm the interim administrator for the Center for Health Protection and the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And my day job that I hope to get back to very soon is manager of the Safe Drinking Water Program within the Public Health Division. And with me today is Curtis Coote, who is the interim section manager for Environmental Public Health, also in the Center for Health Protection. We do actually have a few slides. And, we'll be talking today about safe drinking water and our Healthy Waters programs. And just by way of introduction, yeah, safe and healthy water does matter. And so everybody's interested in it. You know, we were all getting a little thirsty here a minute ago and just talking about it. But anytime things are going on with drinking water, everybody's interested, and there's lots of media attention and public interest. Just wanted to share with you one sort of item of history. I came to work here actually in the early 80s, and back then community waterborne disease outbreaks were actually relatively common. And one of the first things I worked on was a giardiasis outbreak up at the Corbett Water District west of Portland. And you can sort of see here that we've really made inroads into this over time with the federal drinking water standards, the state taking primacy for those. And although the risk of this is still not zero, as evidenced by a major outbreak we had in Baker City a year ago this summer of cryptosporidiosis, that kind of is another reminder of why we have federal drinking water standards and why we have oversight on public water systems. And of course, there have been other things in the news in other parts of the country. We had that chemical spill in West Virginia, and their largest city didn't have safe drinking water for several weeks. And then more recently, Toledo, Ohio had the algal toxin episode this past summer, and they didn't have safe water for another couple of weeks. So those are all reminders of why drinking water is important. Quick overview of how the regulatory system works. It always starts with the public water suppliers. They're the ones that provide safe drinking water to people. They're required to test their water report, and act when standards are not met. The U.S. EPA actually sets national standards under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. By the way, that was 1974, so this is the 40th anniversary of the Safe Drinking Water Act at the national level, so we'll be hearing more about that this fall. And EPA's other role is to oversee the state programs, which is an arrangement called primacy. And then state and county public health and partners, our job under our statute here in Oregon is to assure all Oregonians safe drinking water. So Oregon and 48 other states actually also have primacy for the safe drinking water standards. And people always ask me, what's the one that doesn't? And it's Wyoming. So thanks. Just a few facts about public drinking water systems in Oregon. First of all, there's a lot of them, and maybe more than you would expect. One of the things that I find really important for our program is recognizing and acting on the fact that 90% of the water systems serve fewer than 500 people. And you heard DEQ, our partners, talk about small communities and those issues. We regulate almost 3,500 public water systems all total. We certify the water system operators, and there's thousands of them, 100 certified drinking water labs. There's 91 regulated contaminants under the EPA standards. And public water systems submit about 100,000 test results a year into us. and reported to EPA. Just quick summary of the EPA regulated drinking water contaminants. So I'm not going to go through all 91 of them, thank goodness. But I separate them into these groups, and I've got them listed by how much we're concerned about them at the top, most concerned down to least concern. And so, again, the big issue is bugs, as I like to call them, and so we stay vigilant about that because, as evidenced in the Baker City outbreak, you get a lot of people sick in a hurry. There are about 20 inorganic chemicals. I just mentioned nitrate's a big one from fertilizer application. We have arsenic here in Oregon because of our geology and our volcanic rocks. And while we don't have lead in our drinking water, we have lead materials in some of our plumbing, and that nice, clean, clear water that we know and love here is pretty good at dissolving metal out of plumbing. So that's something we have to pay attention to. We have a lot of standards for solvents and pesticides. I've always been surprised that we don't find more of these in an agricultural state like we are, particularly pesticides. Doesn't mean they're not present. It means they're not present at levels of detection of the methods we use to look for things at levels of concern to health. And then last, really, and least here is radiologic contaminants. It's just not in our geology here in Oregon. Just a quick listing of some of the kinds of things that we do. I'll let you look at those on the left. I don't think anybody here would be surprised by these sorts of activities, really, as a regulatory program. But I do want to point out that we have very significant partnerships. We partner with county health departments across Oregon, and we actually fund them to work with those large numbers of very small systems that we mentioned earlier. You heard already that we partner with DEQ on protecting sources of drinking water, and then we also administer a revolving loan fund on the safe drinking water side that we partner with the Infrastructure Financing Authority to operate. Just a couple of items on our budget to keep in mind. We are overwhelmingly federally funded in our program, so we're subject to those vagaries of federal funding that you already heard about from our partners at DEQ. About a quarter of our budget is other funds and fees, and we do not have any general fund in the drinking water program. A third of our budget supports our partners, which are the county health departments and DEQ and Infrastructure Finance Authority, and about two-thirds of our budget supports our staff and regional offices. Just a couple of things about the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Fund. It's a little more recent than the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund that you heard about from DEQ. It works very much the same way. There are annual capitalization grants from EPA to the states. Each state's share is based on the percent of national infrastructure need survey that's done every 4 years. We apply for the grant. Again, the Infrastructure Financing Authority administers the loan fund for us and actually supplies the state match as well. And I think bottom line here, it's been very successful. So over $280 million awarded to nearly 150 Oregon communities since 1997. And while there are no grants in this, we are allowed to, for communities with need, subsidize the interest rate or even forgive some of the principal, which we do as well. So I think that's been a very successful program. Just to finish up, we do have some national measures that you can sort of compare us against the rest of the country. The first one is the percent of the population served by community water systems that meet the health-based standards throughout the year. And you can see that we compare pretty favorably against the U.S., which means that our large water systems really do consistently meet standards here in Oregon. That's a great thing. You'll see a couple of drops there in 2010 and 2013, and those were those one-day boil water notices in Portland. And so it is reflected there. Let's look at the next one. We have the second measure, which is actually the percent of community systems that meet the health-based standards. So the first one's population, the second one is systems, and the second measure exists because you could have a lot of small water systems not meeting standards, and it would never show up in that percent figure for population. So here you can see, you know, we're doing better in recent years as we've been focusing on the small systems. You know, we've still got work to do here with small systems. And finally, our challenges and opportunities. Gosh, this looks a lot like DEQ's slide, doesn't it? And no surprise there. But of course, there are new federal drinking water standards on the way in the next 5 years and beyond. So there will be more standards. We have ongoing challenges, as I said earlier, for our small water systems. The aging water system infrastructure is part of the whole aging infrastructure issue, so no surprise there. Really an opportunity in terms of protecting sources of drinking water, as I mentioned by DEQ. You know, if we can encourage communities to do things to have the best water available to them, and if we can do it, that also have state policies that sort of keep pollution out of our water, then we have more chance of having safe drinking water on the other end. So emerging contaminants, and Curtis will talk a little bit about at least one of these here in a minute. You know, of course, the algal toxins that we heard about, pharmaceuticals, and all those things that are sort of concern at a national level, and certainly here as well. And then, you know, of course, same issue that DEQ brought up is sort of the federal funding is really what the program operates under, and that's been flat or in decline here for a while. So our real challenge and opportunity is prioritizing our work, make sure we're getting the most public health bang for the buck. And with that, I'll turn it over to Curtis.
Thank you, Dave. Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Curtis Coode. Again, I'm the interim section manager for the Environmental Public Health Programs in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to talk about our collection of healthy waters programs, and this is where we provide a public health perspective in support of primarily Clean Water, Safe Drinking Water Act programs and activities, as well as some other activities. And we'll talk a little bit about our domestic wells program, our harmful algae bloom activities, our beach bacteria monitoring program, as well as our fish consumption program. And I'll try and briefly describe some of the health concerns, the partners that we work with in carrying out our activities, and give you a little bit of information about what we know about conditions in the water. So the first program I have up here is the Domestic Well Safety Program. I won't spend a lot of time on this. Bill Eminger from Benton County is here today to talk about some local activities related to this program. But what we do know is that approximately 23% of Oregonians rely on domestic wells as their primary source of potable water. 23% doesn't sound like a lot, but it really accounts for about 80% of the ground surface of Oregon. So it's a broad area of the state. The main contaminants of concern that we work with in private wells, and this is what folks are testing for, are nitrates, and the main concern with that people talk about is blue baby syndrome. Bacteria can cause nausea and diarrhea, and naturally occurring levels of arsenic. High levels of arsenic can increase cancer risk and have some other health outcomes as well. We're able to carry out this program, which is really about informing well owners about the importance of testing their wells, and informing them about what do the results mean, and how do they take care of their well? How do they treat their water so that they can improve the quality of their water? How they can improve and maintain the quality of their well, and then protect their local groundwater as well, so they can continue to have good water quality. We're doing this through a couple of avenues. One is to develop information that we can provide out to members of the public. We can provide through environmental laboratories where folks are getting their wells tested, as well as through realtor associations. We know there's a Domestic Well Testing Act in Oregon that requires folks to test their wells at the point of sale and provide that information to the buyer as well as to the Oregon Health Authority. We're able, through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention funding, to provide funding to local health departments to carry out these domestic well safety activities. Again, Bill Emminger is here to talk about Benton County activities, and we've been able to provide some funding to Harney County as well over the summer. And again, we're developing these information resources for well owners, tenants, and our partners. And the information that is available through state and federal agencies that are collecting water quality data, we'll be able to better target those sort of prevention and outreach activities. Harmful algae blooms. Our goal in this program is to advise the public on these harmful algae bloom hazards. I want to make clear that we're not a prohibitive program. We're not closing lakes and water bodies. We're merely advising the public when we know that a hazard exists. I mentioned we support research efforts, and that is a very passive support in that we are collecting information about harmful algae blooms and health concerns and are able to help move the science forward. Of course, the main health concerns come through a couple of avenues. One is through skin contact. We know that contacting these cyanotoxins, which are the component of harmful algae blooms, which cause problems. Contact can cause skin irritation or rash. Swallowing the water can lead to symptoms like diarrhea, cramps, nausea, vomiting, dizziness. And we know with dogs that we've seen dog mortalities, dog deaths from contact with these cyanotoxins. So that's a great concern. Our partners, I mentioned the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They had, up until a year ago, provided funding for us to carry out these program activities. So currently we're able to provide support for public health advisories through some other funds, but that's a fairly minimal effort that we're able to sustain. We work with our partners that provide us the data that we need to issue public health advisories, and those would be the folks out in the field, your U.S. Forest Service, your parks and recreation managers, drinking water utilities. We work very closely with the drinking water program when we're aware of a harmful algae bloom so that they're able to inform drinking water providers of the potential risk and start to increase their sampling so that they can continue to assure the safety of their customers. We work closely with the Department of Environmental Quality. You may know about the algae bloom that was announced last night in the Willamette River in Portland, and we're working closely with the DEQ on assessing that situation and informing the public. Here's what we know about harmful algae blooms in monitored water bodies, and I'm going to stress that monitored water bodies. This is where there is higher levels of activity, and our water body manager partners are more concerned about folks recreating in those waters. Or if we hear about a health concern, oftentimes we'll work with those water body managers to look into the situations. You'll see that I have a bunch of orange dots on there. These are water bodies, by and large, that see large recreational activities. You don't see, there's a lot of water, of course, east of the Cascades, and this is not to say that there aren't harmful algae blooms scattered throughout the state. It's just this is where we're getting the information and that we're able to inform the public. The Oregon Beach Monitoring Program, again, is an advisory program where we're working with DEQ. The DEQ is going out and sampling water quality in the surf, as well as in creeks that flow across the beach. We're evaluating that water for high levels of fecal bacteria, and then advising the public, working with local partners to post signage, working with the media to spread the word about high bacteria conditions.
And the concerns, health concerns associated with bacteria, we know that there's increased incidence of ear infections, sore throat, coughing, and sometimes diarrhea, fever, and vomiting. The difficult thing about, you know, I mentioned these health concerns, they're fairly nonspecific and they resemble many other things. So sometimes it can be difficult to tease apart. If you've gotten sick at the beach, was it from the water? Was it from some other activity? So that makes it difficult. But what we do know is that the standards that these criteria are based on come from epidemiological studies of large populations, and we know that certain levels of bacteria do cause certain types of illnesses. So we're trying to at least advise the public on those conditions. Another challenge that we face in beach monitoring is that our beach advisories are based on conditions in the surf. I mentioned that we also sample the fresh water that's flowing across the beach. And in my mind, if I'm going to the beach and if I have young children, I'm probably not going to want them playing in the surf so much. The water's pretty cold. It can be pretty treacherous. I'd rather have them playing in the creeks. That's nice, warm, slowly moving water. That's oftentimes where we see the problems that lead to high levels of bacteria in the surf. We're able to post advisories about these situations and then work with municipalities, and this is where the opportunities come in. We and DEQ are able to work with local municipalities to help find and address and fix these problems and therefore improve water quality at the beach, which is really our goal, is to make sure that we have good water quality at the beach when we're swimming. This map shows over the last 7 years where we've had health advisories at our monitored beaches, and we can't possibly monitor all of the beaches. So we look at beaches that have high use and higher potential for bacteria contamination. And again, we have seen success in working with certain municipalities, for instance, Newport and Nye Beach, and working with folks down at Harris Beach, and recently working with folks in Cannon Beach and at Oswald West State Park to help address those situations that we've identified. So that's I see that as a great success. Another one of the challenges I'd like to mention before we move on, it does involve funding. We're currently funded by the EPA. The president has zero funded the EPA beach program in the last few budgets. So Congress is able to restore that funding each session. So we've been on a year-by-year basis for the last few years, and able to continue our efforts and hopeful that will continue into the future. But I had to bring that to your attention. Last program I'd like to mention is our fish consumption advisory program, and what we're trying to do is provide information to help make healthy choices about fish to eat. The main concerns that we see in fish in Oregon have to do with mercury, and mercury it can lead to impaired fetal brain development. High levels of mercury can lead to irritability, vision memory problems, and tremors in adults. And I'll show you in a bit where we're seeing those issues. We also find high levels of PCBs in certain fish, and those can lead also to impaired fetal brain development and increased risk of cancer for people of all ages. However, given those health concerns, we also like to provide messages that fish is a healthy and nutritious food, so that people should continue to eat fish. And what we're trying to do is advise folks that some fish have contaminants that pose health risks, and inform them on the safe levels of fish consumption. Our funding comes some through the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registries. It's part of the CDC, And there, that's an agency that helps us identify cleanup sites and potential contamination and inform the public. We also have some funding, other funding, that helps us address fish consumption, harmful algae blooms, and support other drinking water and DEQ water issues. Now, this map here shows the advisories we've posted over the last 7 years. The purple dots indicate where we have advisories related to PCBs. And PCBs are a cause from legacy industrial activities. We see mercury advisories scattered throughout the state. And those can come from a variety of issues. Depending on the area, they can come from local emissions, they can come from local geology, or they can come from global emissions, air deposition onto the surface of the waters or the soil, and then erosion into the waters. So we see, while we see orange dots around the state, if we were able to monitor all the water bodies in the state, we would likely find higher levels of mercury in the fish throughout the state. In fact, there's only three water bodies that we found so far that are we would say they're safe relative to mercury, and that would be Crater Lake, Palina Lake, and Hag Lake. So this is the situation that we face with fish consumption. So I'll leave the committee with that information, and if there is time for questions.
Yeah, I think we're going to go ahead with our other presenters, and hopefully we'll have a little time for a question or two. After the next presenters. Thank you. Really appreciate your presentation. And while the next presenters are coming up, I'm hoping that our questions that we write down and give the committee administrator, if they're not too expansive, we'll be able to get those questions and answered, put onto OLIS at some point, so that the public can see what we wanted to know.
So while I'm waiting for the presentation to come up, I'll entertain you for a moment.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Oh, absolutely. My name's Bill Emminger. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Benton County Health Department.
Thank you.
You know, when people ask me what we do in environmental health, I jokingly like to tell people, if you eat it, drink it, flush it, swim in it, sleep in it, throw it out, recycle it, or inhale it, we regulate it or know somebody who does. So we cover everything from food safety to drinking water, air quality kinds of issues, on-site septic systems, and the list goes on and on and on. One of the pieces that we're deeply involved in is outbreak investigations, whether they're foodborne or waterborne outbreak investigations. And a couple years ago, we were participating in an outbreak investigation that involved norovirus that was linked back to oyster consumption. And out of that, we made some phone calls, found additional cases. Very quickly, we identified that the company where the oysters were being processed from, the bed where the oysters were being harvested from. Ultimately, it resulted in an international recall of that product. More importantly for me, it was kind of like a drama playing out. We were able to intervene and have the product recalled less than 12 hours before a seafood festival was to begin on the coast. So you probably never heard about the outbreak that never occurred. That was the one. So let's go ahead and get started. And let's see. The previous presenters, I think, did an excellent job of capping the DEQ and Oregon Health Authority roles in all of this at the local level. We're involved in regulating of on-site wastewater systems, primarily for homes or small businesses, and on the public water system side for very small public water systems under about 3,300 and at our groundwater source. It might surprise you to know how many of those small public water systems may be in your county. For Benton County, we have 72 of them. And those are typically small community systems, small cities, trailer parks, schools, restaurants are the kinds of small public water systems that we regulate on in our agreement with Oregon Health Authority. And then there's this area called domestic wells. Over 3,500 private wells are in Oregon. We estimate that 23% of the wells in the U.S. are tested. So when I look at just Benton County data, we've got about 10,000 wells in Benton County. That means about 7,700 of those wells have never, emphasis on the word, never been tested. We have no idea what people are drinking in those private homes. The other thing that we're noticing is that people are increasingly becoming more concerned about the quality of their groundwater and drinking water well. Oregon currently has three groundwater management areas identified in the state. Groundwater management area is declared when widespread nitrate concentration becomes a concern by DEQ. As you notice, one of those groundwater management areas involves Benton County, Linn County, and Lane County. This little gray area here is the actual groundwater management area. The Domestic Well Testing Act does require homeowners to test domestic wells at time of a real estate transaction, and they test for total coliform, arsenic, and nitrate. But unfortunately, some of the weakness of the act is that there is no provisions for enforcement, and the sale is not contingent on testing. And this only applies to real estate transactions. So some new construction or pre-existing homes, I call them legacy homes, may have never been tested. If you have a home that is passed down from generation to generation to generation, you could have multiple generations of families living, say, on a farm or a business property, and that well may have never been tested. So the groundwater management areas really kind of piqued my concern. We have areas basically east of Highway 99 in Benton County that is a shallow alluvial aquifer. It's uncapped. And a lot of elevated nitrates in that area of Benton County, and it's basically a mirror portion of that over in Linn County as well, too. And some of those levels have exceeded safe drinking water levels. And so the groundwater management area work group is a citizen work group. We have a county commissioner from each one of the counties that have been assigned to the groundwater management area. And there's ongoing discussions about what we can do to voluntarily lower the nitrate concentration in that area. That program has been in place for about 10 years. We've got a mixed bag. Some wells are getting better. Some wells are getting worse. Some wells are holding about the same. But I think generally overall we're seeing a general improvement in that area. Some of the things we're testing for, the slide I had before, was coliforms. Coliforms can certainly be an indication if there's a damage to the well housing or supply lines to the home, and bacteria is entering that. Total coliforms can be bacteria that can cause illness or not. What we're really concerned about is something called fecal coliforms or E. coli. Those are the pathogens that can cause pretty serious illness and if that's encountered. And typically an E. coli hit is what the State Drinking Water Program uses as a trigger for boil water notices and that sort of thing. Arsenic, we have some concerns about. And looking at some geological reports for Benton County, I noticed that we had some areas that had low level of arsenic, but really was kind of curious what we might find in well water if we tested for arsenic. Very little to no data regarding that in Benton County. And so through the grant, through Oregon Health Authority, through the Domestic Well Safety Program, we got a small grant for $5,000 that allowed us to pay for some testing in 90 homes that volunteered for the program. Nitrate, again, is another chemical that we have concern about. Nitrate replaces oxygen in the circulatory system, so that creates a condition called blue baby syndrome. High levels of nitrates have been reported as causing things like spontaneous abortions. One woman I interviewed said that she had had four or five miscarriages, and she knew that she had elevated nitrates in her drinking water. And she thought they had done the right thing by putting reverse osmosis on their supply. But what they had missed is she liked drinking her water out of the cold water dispenser on the refrigerator. And that line, when it got plumbed into the water supply line, got plumbed in before the reverse osmosis. Once they figured that out and moved the water supply line, cheap fix, she was able to deliver and have a normal pregnancy. The state has got an intern a couple years ago, and she went in and looked at all of these lab results for a real estate transaction test from 1989 to 2008. And this is another piece of data that I looked at in thinking about, well, do I want to apply for this domestic well safety grant or not? And out of this, they found that during a real estate transaction, 19% of the wells tested positive for total coliforms. 2.3 had elevated nitrates that was close to violating the safe drinking water level. And at 7 to 9 parts per million is typically the range that DEQ might look at an area to give some consideration. Well, maybe we need to create a groundwater management area. And 1.8% of the wells tested exceeded the safe drinking water level of 10 parts per million. Interesting point. This is a very small subset of all wells that are out there. These are only wells that are being tested as part of a real estate transaction. And because there's not a mandatory requirement for reporting, it's probably even a subset of that. So she then went about plotting the results on a map. And so the gray dots will give you an idea of where the positive coliform hits occurred in the state. The yellow dots are nitrate from 7 to 9 parts per million. And the red dots are nitrate levels that exceeded 10 parts per million. So coming back to our program in Benton County, we partnered with a lot of different state agencies, OSU, Oregon Water Resources, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the Groundwater Management Advisory folks. We also partnered with Oregon Health Authority, and particularly the Domestic Well Safety Program. They're ones that provided a small $5,000 grant. And we used that grant money to buy 90 tests through Edge Analytical. And those tests were for total coliforms, and if they got a positive, they would test for E. coli. That's the bug I'm concerned from a public health standpoint. Arsenic and nitrate. Oregon State University was very helpful in coming to me and saying, look, we will do the testing for nitrates because we've got a program that can do that now. We'll do the testing for nitrates for you for free. So that allowed me to buy more of the total coliforms and arsenic tests. Our results very closely mirrored what the state found in their real estate transaction results. And out of the 90 homes tested, 16% were positive for total coliforms. So far, we've not found any E. coli. We've got a few test results that are still pending, so this is very preliminary data. But probably 90% of the results are in at this point. Arsenic, we're finding about 16%, which was kind of a surprise for me, that tested positive for arsenic. The level that exceeded the safe drinking water level was about 3.3%. And then nitrates, we found 17 properties that tested positive for nitrates, and about 4.4% of those either met or exceeded the safe drinking water contamination level. So some interesting results. We used a lot of OSU interns and volunteers in the program. Probably got 6-7 people that are currently working on this program as volunteers or interns. One of my interns who was supposed to leave after 3 months has been with me for 9 months and signed up for another 3 months. So he'll be putting in a year with me as an intern or volunteer. And the work from those university students were really critical for the success of this program. What we did is we went out and as we tested each one of the home's wells, we also did a visual inspection of the well. And so we're finding some interesting results out of that as well. Many homeowners don't even know where their wells are located. They don't know what to test for if they could test. And in some cases, we're finding septic systems that are located too close to the wells as well. So more analysis of that data will be going on in the next few months, and hope to have more results to share in the very near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk some more and see the results of those tests.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Up next, as we're really pressing our time, Kimberly Swan and Mark Yeager. I'll have you come up together so we can keep moving. Good morning and welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes. Representative Chair Hobley and representatives, thank you for having us here today. For the record, my name is Kim Swan. I'm the water resource manager for the Clackamas River Water Providers. We actually are a coalition of all the cities and water districts that get their drinking water out of the Clackamas River. But I'm actually here today as chair of the Oregon Water Utility Council. So I was asked to give the municipal water provider perspective on water quality. So I'm going to start with just a really quick background on who OWOC is, and then just highlight a couple challenges and opportunities. And I may echo quite a bit of what you heard from Dave and Curtis. So first of all, the Oregon Water Utility Council is a committee of the Pacific Northwest section, which is a section of the American Water Works Association. And it's made up of cities, special districts, public utility districts, and private companies. And collectively, our members provide drinking water to more than 75% of the population in Oregon. Our mission is to promote and monitor legislation, public policy, and regulations to ensure that our communities are provided drinking water at the highest quality, have sufficient quality, and that we can do this at the most reasonable costs. So just kind of in general, what water utilities need is that we need to continue to have a robust and ongoing good relationship with both the Oregon Water Resource Department and the Oregon Health Authority. Those are the two agencies we work the closest with. So I'm going to highlight very quickly three challenges. So there's been a lot of talk, and I was getting emails yesterday about blue-green algae advisories. So blue-green algae toxins in drinking water is something that is becoming more aware, and our public is becoming concerned with. The city of Toledo, Ohio, earlier this year was a great example of a large city where 500,000 people were issued a do not drink order. Here in Oregon, the Oregon Water Utility Council members working with OHA actually developed best management practices that were created to help water providers address what happens when there are harmful algal blooms. And what these best management practices do is it provides information for drinking water providers, one, to know how to monitor for these blooms, what toxins they should test for if the blooms turn out to be toxins, and what kind of water treatment options we have available to us to help mitigate for potential toxins. An example of this is the city of Salem, as well as the water providers in the basin I work in. We have been implementing these BMPs, and due to having harmful algal blooms upriver from where our drinking water intakes are, we've been taking samples both of raw water and finished water to see if we have detections. So these best management practices have been really good guidelines on how to understand and be prepared to change our treatment if we need. Another challenge, which was touched on earlier, are emerging contaminants. Unregulated pesticides, pharmaceutical and personal care products are found in low levels in many of our Oregon rivers, which are surface water sources. And many of these are unregulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, but they are a concern to our citizens when they hear that we're finding these in our source water. In addition, EPA's unregulated contaminant monitoring program continues to put a burden of monitoring and testing and costs associated with that to look at unregulated contaminants, and that's a financial burden on us. And then, as Dave hit on earlier, drinking water infrastructure continues to be a huge challenge for us. And fixing and repairing old and aging infrastructure is key for us to be able to continue to provide meet municipal water needs now and into the future. And in 2010, the American Society of Civil Engineers found that here in Oregon, we had close to $2.8 billion in drinking water infrastructure needs over the next 20 years. So that will continue to be a challenge for us to meet and provide safe, clean drinking water. Now, on the more positive side, there are also lots of opportunities for us. One are the creation of best management practices. The Oregon Water Utility Council, along with the Drinking Water Advisory Committee, have developed over the last number of years a number of best management practices to help maintain water quality and protect public health. These guidelines describe best practices that water systems can and water suppliers are encouraged to incorporate into their ongoing programs and operations. And there's four that we currently have in the state. There's a BMP for cutting and repairing into existing water mains, disinfection or filtration treatment plant interruptions, so what happens if you had an interruption, and what happens if you have surface outages due to pressure events. And then the last one is the harmful algal blooms that I mentioned earlier. So these, again, aren't regulatory, but they're guidelines that provide us guidance on how to maintain high-quality drinking water and water quality. Another opportunity that was touched on earlier is source water protection. There are lots of opportunities, and we're starting to see many more drinking water, municipal water providers having active, engaging in source water protection efforts. So understanding our upstream risks to drinking water, whether it comes from forestry activities, agricultural activities, septic systems, hazardous materials that is either transported or stored in our watersheds, upstream of water intakes, is really important, because the more we understand what those risks are, the better ability we have to work with those stakeholders and be able to work with our regulators and our other basin programs and organizations to help protect water quality. So that is a very positive. And then lastly, pollution prevention is also very key. Obviously, the cleaner we can keep our source water, keeping those pollutants from entering to begin with, obviously allows us to have cleaner water for us to treat for human consumption, and will help us and give us the ability to keep our water treatment costs low into the future. That's it.
Good morning. Is this on? Good morning, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Mark Yeager. I work for the City of Albany as Utility Services Manager. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies. The Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies is 120 members that are dedicated to enhancing and protecting Oregon's water quality. We provide services to 2.4 million people in Oregon, 63% of the homes and businesses in the state. I'm going to talk with you also a little bit about challenges and opportunities that the wastewater treatment and stormwater management agencies face as we move forward. Thinking about how we best move forward, one of the things that is paramount to these agencies is that we have to make long-term investments. You heard Jennifer talking earlier about facilities that last 30 years. Well, the grant program is gone. We need to have certainty with respect to regulatory environment and with the types of things that we have to face as treatment managers. In addition to the certainty, We also need to have knowledgeable and effective state natural resource agencies, including DEQ. It's important because these issues are very complex, and we work collaboratively with these agencies, so it's very important that we have good, knowledgeable, effective staff at those agencies. Some of the challenges that we face as wastewater treatment and stormwater management agencies include things like Oregon adopted in 2011 the most toxic water quality, the most stringent toxic water quality standards in the nation. There's no affordable treatment technology available for that. There's new chemicals being introduced into our environment all the time. And at the moment, we don't have a permit strategy. It's unclear how we're going to make the permit strategy work. For example, in Albany, in 2008, 2009, 2010, we invested $80 million into our wastewater treatment system. Before this water quality standard was adopted, nothing that we invested in that treatment facility is going to be effective at removing these toxic water, meeting these toxic water quality standards. The Federal Clean Water Act is outdated, as Jennifer highlighted for you. It was initially envisioned to solve problems one parameter at a time. We can't continue to approach water quality management in that way. Chasing molecules at treatment plants isn't going to get the job done. So we've got to be thinking about it in a more holistic way. The watershed approach involving all sectors needs to be the way that we're going to solve water quality problems. Looking forward to opportunities that we have, use of natural treatment systems. I included in my testimony that was handed out to you a handout that we recently completed highlighting some of the natural treatment systems that are being used in Oregon. The treatment systems like wetlands can be a good match for many of the small communities out there. They're effective, that they're less capital intensive, and they're also more effective at in terms of operating costs. Many of the wastewater treatment agencies in particular are going through a waste to commodity transition now, which means that we are looking within our facilities to find ways to produce renewable energy. We're looking at ways to extract products from our waste streams that we can use in a productive, reusable way. The city of Gresham will be the first community in Oregon to go and be 100% off the grid in terms of generating energy. So I know your other hats that you wear are the energy piece. We'd like to invite you, if you're interested in taking a tour of the city of Gresham's wastewater treatment plant, and highlight some of the things that they're doing there. But they have solar photovoltaic issues, or facilities that they've installed, and they use biogas also for generating electricity. Recycled water can be used to meet the ever-increasing needs for water supply. We have diminishing water supplies. There's no new water in the world. The water that we can extract from the wastewater treatment system can be used effectively on many different in many different applications. So the recycled water approach is also one that we need to be thinking about. And finally, I'm going to echo Kim in terms of pollution prevention. That is critical to improving water quality. Wastewater treatment plants don't manufacture anything. We have to treat what comes to us in the wastewater stream. There's several ad campaigns. You might have seen them in your city. Toilets are not trash cans. We have to think about and educate people about what they should and should not dispose of down the drain. Those products, many of them, our treatment plants aren't designed to remove those. So we have to be focusing on pollution prevention as a way to improve water quality in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this presentation. I think it was a good overview of water quality, and we are actually about 5 minutes behind schedule. So we're going to, you know, hopefully get the presenters some questions to get an answer for us in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee, I assume that if you need to take a break, that you can go ahead and do that. But I'm going to try to take about three minutes or so, and then we'll start back up in about 3 minutes.
Three?
Would you like five?
Three and a half.
I need that because that's important at the same time. to be connecting.
I'd like to go ahead and reconvene and get started back up on our next section. We're going to start out with renewable energy. So I'd like to have Andy Ginsberg and Anthony Buckley. From the Department of Energy. Good morning, thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the administrator of the Planning Policy and Technical Analysis Division at the State Department of Energy. And with me is Anthony Buckley, the administrator of our Energy Development Services Division. And we're here today to provide information about renewable energy in Oregon and to set the stage for the rest of today's presenters. We'll cover the state of renewable energy in Oregon and identify a few important trends and issues. And following our presentation, Jason Eisdorfer of the Public Utility Commission will cover renewable energy authorities and programs. Renewable energy is at the crossroads of the economy and the environment. It can produce long-term savings in energy costs in a number of ways. Diversifying our energy resources can reduce long-term risks and improve the resilience of our energy distribution system. And producing renewable energy in Oregon reduces the flow of money out of state for energy purchases, creates jobs, and supports key Oregon resource industries such as forestry and irrigated farming. Energy isn't just electricity. Oregon uses a substantial amount of energy for transportation and for space and process heating. As you can see, these three sectors have some overlap, as electricity can heat our homes and increasingly can provide power for our cars. Oregon's utilities and stakeholders have played a significant role in advancing renewable energy in all three of these sectors. From 2010 to 2012, Oregon used an average of about 47,600 gigawatt hours of electricity per year, about half of which came from renewable energy. This chart is a compilation of all utilities and includes electricity produced both in-state and out-of-state for use in Oregon. While the electricity resource mix hasn't changed much for the past 5 years, we expect the coal portion to decline as plants throughout the region close or reduce generation. Also, the renewables portion will increase when the renewable portfolio standard ramps up in 2015, 2020, and 2025. The renewable share should also increase from the statewide goal to have 8% of Oregon's electricity load served by community-based renewable energy projects by 2025. This slide shows the energy used for residential and commercial space heating as well as for industrial process heat. In the residential sector, 7% of Oregonians use renewable fuel, which is wood, to heat their homes. Industrial process heat accounts for about half of the thermal energy used in the state and about half of the total energy used by industry. Combined heat and power is an approach this sector can use to not only improve energy efficiency, but in some cases also increase the use of renewables. Gasoline and diesel dominate the transportation portfolio, but ethanol and biodiesel also play significant roles thanks to the renewable fuel standard. Between 2005 and 2013, overall transportation fuel consumption declined by 115 million gallons per year, while the proportion of non-petroleum fuel rose from a little over 1.5% to nearly 9%. Some renewable energy sources, such as solar and wind, are not consistently available. As variable renewable energy resources increasingly come online, there's a regional collaboration to develop tools to integrate more renewable energy. Other renewables resources, such as hydropower and bioenergy, can be stored and used as needed. Geothermal projects can provide baseload energy because the resource is consistent, and wave energy is expected to be predictable. A resource, since the sea state changes relatively gradually and we have many tools already in place to forecast conditions. Also, because there's no fuel cost for most forms of renewable energy investments don't have the fuel price risk of traditional resources such as natural gas. Instead, costs for many renewables tend to be front-loaded. And this is why upfront capital and financial assistance are important for developing renewable energy projects. Another key feature of renewable energy is location, meaning we must go to where the resource is. Fortunately, Oregon has most types of renewable energy, and communities may have multiple options to develop renewable resources. I'll now highlight key trends for renewable energy in Oregon, beginning with solar power. This map shows that the Southwest United States has the greatest photovoltaic resource, but Oregon has a significant solar resource, particularly east of the Cascades. Over 87 megawatts of photovoltaics have been installed in Oregon to date using incentive programs established by the legislature. And the cost of photovoltaics is rapidly declining based on data from our residential tax credit program. Residential Energy Tax Credit Program. The cost of residential systems has dropped by over 50% in the last decade, and costs are even lower for industrial and utility applications due to economies of scale. The department expects costs to continue to decline as volume increases and rapid developments in electronics continue. And the department is also working to reduce the soft costs for paperwork, permitting, and interconnection. This slide shows Oregon's wind resources, strongest and most consistent in eastern Oregon. Most development to date has taken place in the Columbia River Gorge due to access to transmission, but some projects have been proposed in southeast Oregon. Installed wind capacity in Oregon is through 2012 is over 3,000 megawatts from 40 projects. As a coastal state, Oregon also has access to significant offshore resources, wind resources, particularly in the southern coast. This technology is very promising because turbines can be very large and efficient, and wind far offshore can be more consistent than wind over land. Principal Power has proposed a project over 10 miles off the coast of Coos Bay, where they hope to deploy 5 floating turbines called wind floats. Oregon has over 100 bioenergy facilities throughout the state. These include biofuel production facilities, pellet boilers in schools, anaerobic digesters at dairies. And these systems often produce significant co-benefits, such as providing markets for mill residues, farm wastes, and food waste. Most of Oregon's hydropower comes from large hydroelectric dams, but irrigation districts are leading the way on new hydropower development, which can help a district offset system maintenance expenses and create revenue with a limited environmental footprint. Piping canals can have significant co-benefits, including increasing water pressure for irrigation and returning water in stream. Oregon has a significant untapped opportunity in geothermal energy development. Klamath Falls has used geothermal energy for district heating since the 1980s, while Lakeview is now bringing district heating system online. The Oregon Institute of Technology has been producing geothermal electricity. They began in 2010, and they had a significant expansion in 2014. And this, together with a solar photovoltaic system, has enabled OIT to meet most of the energy needs on campus from renewable energy. And in 2012, U.S. Geothermal brought online Oregon's first utility-scale geothermal project, a 26-megawatt facility near Vail. Wave energy is still in the R&D phase, with no commercial projects yet in the country. In addition to supplying renewable energy, future wave energy projects could improve the resilience of the coastal grid. As you can see, the West Coast has tremendous wave energy resources, which creates both an opportunity and a challenge for equipment operating in a harsh environment. That's why Oregon State University's Marine Energy Test Center is so important. The center will be located about 6 miles offshore to the south of Newport and connected to the electrical grid. This will allow testing of a wide variety of wave energy devices, supporting Oregon's role as a U.S. leader in wave energy R&D. About 2 weeks ago, M3 Wave began a short pilot of a wave energy device on the northern Oregon coast, about a mile from offshore from Camp Rylea. This is the first wave energy project to be deployed under the Territorial Sea Plan, and while it's not connected to the grid, the device is exceeding expectations, according to M3. Anthony.
Thank you, Andy.
Chair Holvey, co-chairs, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Anthony Buckley. I'm the administrator for Oregon Department of Energy's Energy Development Services Division. The department provides a variety of products and services to help the state support and grow its renewable energy portfolio. Through our loan program, we provide access to capital for project developers. Our grant program provides a cash award of up to 35%, but no more than $250,000, specifically for renewable energy projects. There are also a wide variety of incentives available for conservation and transportation energy projects. We also facilitate the siting of large plants with renewable fuel sources. Of the products we offer, I want to take the opportunity to highlight the state's energy loan program. Oregon's small-scale energy loan program, better known as SELP, is quite possibly the oldest energy loan program in the United States. Today, we see other states launching similar programs under the moniker of Green Banks. To date, SELP has provided well over $600 million in loan funding for energy projects throughout Oregon. The loan program provides project developers with not only capital, but also technical expertise. Our loan terms are flexible and interest rates are set to provide borrowers a lower cost alternative to commercial lending options. Over the past 3 years, we've provided a little over $30 million in financings specifically for renewable energy projects. I want to be clear on one point. Our intent is not to compete with the commercial banking community. SELP is an alternative that fills a void created by the commercial banking community's conservative risk profile and, in some cases, a lack of energy project financing knowledge. We're a complement to the services and financing that they offer. SELP provides not only the financial resources, again, but also much-needed technical expertise. We mitigate our lending risk by thoroughly evaluating the benefits and potential for success of proposed projects. Over its 34 years, SELP has proven to be a valuable alternative for energy project financing. In summary, our state has significant and varied renewable energy resources that can support our energy goals, while providing numerous co-benefits to Oregonians and to Oregon industries and communities. While we face a variety of technical, financial, and institutional challenges in expanding use of these resources, Oregon has made substantial progress towards our energy goals thanks to strong support from our utilities and stakeholders. Loans and the department's other programs can help overcome some of these barriers. With that, that ends our presentation. We'd be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Boone and Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Jason Eisthorff. I'm the program director at the Public Utility Commission. I am going to follow up on the introductory comments of my colleagues here, and I was asked to cover a couple of key points. One is a survey of current renewable energy policy in the state. This is something of a challenge to do in the next 10 or 11 minutes, but we'll try to run through it, and then also begin to touch on some of the drivers that create both challenges and opportunities for renewable energy in Oregon. So I'm throwing all of this. I apologize at the outset when you describe lots of statutes, you have to do it with using words, not pictures so much. I threw all of these up there on one particular side to make really two points. One is the electricity arena is a pretty broad canvas. There are a lot of players. There's the utilities, the customers, there are market participants, the regulators, and there are a lot of issues. There's affordability, there's reliability, there's environmental sustainability. And so we don't yet, at this point anyway, have one renewable energy policy that covers everybody and all technologies. So what we ended up doing here is sort of creating a taxonomy that looked at the existing policies and tried to group them. And here we group them into planning, standards, incentives, voluntary programs, and then we threw in some federal policy there at the end. The other takeaway from this slide is a similar and related aspect, which is if you're, since we're doing this sort of in a piecemeal basis, some of these policies are going to apply to some players and not others. Some of these policies are going to apply to some types of technologies and not others. So, for example, the utility resource planning, the integrated resource plan, is really a function of the Public Utility Commission. Therefore, it applies actually to all resources, not just renewables, but it only applies to the investor-owned utilities, PGE, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. The renewable portfolio standard covers a variety of technologies, but it also applies to all utilities. The difference here is that the various percentages, and I'll cover all of these individually in a moment, the percentages shift depending upon the size of the utility, not whether it's publicly owned or investor-owned. The solar capacity standard applies only to solar and the investor-owned utilities. Net metering applies to all Oregon utilities and a range of resources. But here we're really focusing on the customer experience. We're not telling the utility you must invest in a particular resource. And likewise, the volumetric incentive rate or the feed-in tariff applies to the IOUs only, but just to solar. So you can see that there's, pick a policy and you're not really sure necessarily who applies to. So let's start off with the integrated resource planning. This is from the commission, and it's the commission asks the investor-owned utilities every 2 years to take a 20-year look at the resource needs of that particular utility. And ultimately, what we're trying to get there is the utility and its stakeholders to try to put together a portfolio of resources that would serve these customers in the least cost, least risk manner. Utilities are told to treat energy efficiency and renewable energy on par with all other kinds of generating assets. And then ultimately, there's a 3 to 5 year action plan, which is where the rubber meets the road. The Renewable Portfolio Standard, established in 2007, this applies to all utilities in the state, but and requires the utilities to meet their load using a certain percentage of renewable energy to meet that load. And it's split into three different groups, the largest, sort of medium, and then the smallest utilities. The three largest utilities, PGE, PacifiCorp, and EWEB, 15% of load must be met with renewable resources by 2015, 20% by 2020, and 25% by 2025. Eligible resources are actually quite broad here, as long as they were developed after 1999. The point here was really to move forward and develop renewable resources and not rely on existing. There's been some discussion in the past about how hydro does not count. The large hydro on the federal system doesn't count because those are much older dams. But efficiency upgrades to those dams would count for the renewable portfolio standard. The solar capacity standard is another one of these in the rubric of standards. This one applies only to the investor-owned utilities, and there's a 20 megawatt cap or a 20 megawatt goal here. The Public Utility Commission then sort of allocated that 20 megawatts to the three IOUs. And I think that, at least with regard to PacifiCorp and PGE, they have already reached this goal. So this this one is almost mission accomplished. And here's a small version of the makeup of the renewable generation by year and fuel type for each of PGE and PacifiCorp. You can see the relative elements here. In particular, you can see solar is just a very thin margin at the very top. Okay, so there's a lot on this slide, and we're just going to cover these at a very surface level. Net metering does apply to all customers of all utilities. And that metering is basically saying if a customer invests in a renewable resource on site, and there are limitations for how big that can be, to the extent that that generation is generating electricity, it nets out the amount of electricity the customer is buying from the utility. So in theory, at the end of the year, if the solar panels on my roof generate the same amount that I use from the utility, I basically net to a zero. There are incentives here to make sure that those systems are right-sized and the customer is not sort of over-generating. In 1149 from 1999, there was the public purpose charge. 17% of that goes to renewable energy projects under 20 megawatts. The Energy Trust of Oregon administers this, and the current focus is on solar, irrigation, district hydro, biopower, et cetera. And then finally, the feed-in tariff. The feed-in tariff really is a pilot program, and it's an experiment in long-term contracts with the owner of the renewable energy selling to the utility. And this is a pilot project that has an end date of 2017, I think it is, and a size limit, which we are approaching as we speak. Two voluntary programs I wanted to mention. One is also from Senate Bill 49. It was a mandate to the investor-owned utilities to provide their customers with options in containing significant new renewable resources. This is a REC-based program, a renewable energy certificate-based program. And right now, PGE is number one in the country for a number of customers who have signed up for it, and Pacific Corp is number two. So that is working very well. This is a residential program. And recently, there has been a fair amount of interest from the commercial industrial community about voluntary programs for renewable energy to be offered to them as well. Earlier this year in the short session, HB 4126 was passed that asked the commission to look at whether it was appropriate to have the utility make these offerings. And this gets complicated because these customers also have opportunity to get direct access to leave their utility and go shop in the market. And so one of the things that the commission has to look at is whether or not it is appropriate for the utility to be offering renewable programs, options that these customers might be able to get in the market. And then finally, in terms of policies, there's the federal PURPA. This was passed in 1978 and basically says, this was actually not a renewable energy policy initially. It was actually a policy to try to create wholesale activity. And so the law created qualifying facilities and said that if the QF can offer to the utility energy at the utility's avoided cost or below, that the utility has to go and buy that from that developer. This has been used in the renewable energy community, and there's actually a line of potential QFs currently in front of the commission. This avoided cost issue, I think we will revisit this in a moment. This is one of the key drivers that I'll talk about in a moment. Okay, so here are the drivers. I put them all up there all at once to take a look at them, and I'll go through each one of them and spend about a minute on each. The first one is the Clean Air Act and the EPA. The second bullet, the 111D, is the one that's getting a lot of press these days. Just yesterday, the DEQ extended the comments due date from the states and from interested persons from mid-October to December 1st. This is the regulation of carbon dioxide from existing electricity generating units. And the EPA essentially created goals for each state using a number of buckets. Renewable energy is one of the ways that they created those goals. Renewable energy is one of the ways that a state could comply with those. So this is still a couple of years in the making, but it's really the first holistic approach on the electricity sector to address climate change. energy imbalance market. As Andy said, wind and solar in particular are variable energy resources. They produce energy when the wind blows and when the sun shines. There is now, and there always will be, a difficult time for utilities to balance load and generation. It's always a struggle. With additional variable energy on the system, it exacerbates that problem. The energy imbalance market is one of the potential solutions. It is a market-based platform. It expands the geography of generating units to be able to help balance wind and solar. And right now, PacifiCorp is proposing to join with a California independent system operator. There's a docket in front of the commission right now to look at the benefits and costs of that proposal. There's also a similar investigation going on in the Northwest. I think I'm going to defer to Crystal with BPA to describe that process, but that's basically the same kind of concept, the energy imbalance market, and whether or not it would serve the Northwest. And then energy storage, a number of folks, including myself, have said that energy storage may be the holy grail in the electricity sector. It can do a number of things. Clearly, it can help integrate wind at a higher level. Some of the energy storage is still in the developing stage. It's still expensive, but it certainly is coming. This is really the last substantive slide, and there are two takeaways from this one. One is this is a slide showing the wellhead price of natural gas, and the two takeaways are, one, natural gas prices can be quite volatile. Twice in the last 8 years, the price of or the cost of natural gas at the wellhead has been five times more than the lowest point on this graph. So it can be a very volatile thing, and renewable energy can be an important part of the portfolio to alleviate the risk of volatile fuel markets. The other thing to take away, though, is looking at 2012 and beyond. Right now, we are in a period of historically low gas prices. This makes it more difficult for renewable energy to compete with natural gas resource. There are some folks who say that the shale revolution is going to keep gas down low, but I think a lot of the people in the sitting back there with decades of experience in the electricity industry have heard that before. You can't predict where natural gas is going. All we can say at this point is it's low, and that becomes a challenge for renewable energy. And then the technology drivers, I won't go into. I think Andy did a nice job. Solar, the cost of solar panels are coming down. Just as wind technology came, the price of wind technology came down during the 80s and 90s. Floating wind turbines, he talked about a little bit. That's still sort of in the revolutionary stage. And again, energy storage is something we all look forward to. So with that, I think we're open for questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your presentation. And we're going to go ahead and listen to the rest of the panel. And on this group, we may end up having a little bit of room for questions, perhaps, at the end. Well, I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to present first.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Crystal Ball. And maybe we'll have Jason Huser and Ted Case come up as well. Good morning. Thank you very much for coming today. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Crystal Ball. I'm the Oregon liaison at the Bonneville Power Administration. Thank you for this opportunity to explain how BPA is integrating the region's new renewable resources. BPA is a federal power marketing administration created by Congress to market the power produced by federal dams and build the infrastructure to develop that power. The federal resource is a major component of Oregon's electricity mix, and BPA's transmission system is the region's electric backbone. Over 15,000 circuit miles of BPA high voltage transmission lines crisscross the Pacific Northwest, moving energy from where it's generated to where it's consumed. Because most new renewable energy in our region is coming from wind generation located from population centers, additional high voltage transmission is needed to ensure reliable delivery of that energy. At BPA, we have made extraordinary investments in the federal transmission system to integrate new renewable resources, currently spending about $500 million a year to expand and maintain the federal transmission system. BPA completed a major transmission project in 2012, and more projects are underway. Just this spring, we broke ground on a new project that will allow PGE to get wind power from the Toucannon River Wind Farm in eastern Washington to PGE's customers in western Oregon. These new projects will add more than 225 miles of high-voltage transmission to the federal transmission grid, improving reliability and enabling the delivery of about 3,700 megawatts of additional energy for our region. BPA is also considering joint participation with Idaho Power and PacifiCorp in a proposed transmission project from Boardman to Hemingway, Idaho. These investments support Governor Kitzhaber's goal for enhancing clean energy infrastructure and will help BPA accommodate the region's growing energy needs. New renewable energy development has been an extraordinary opportunity to add new renewable resources to the Pacific Northwest mix. We've adapted to this new resource by changing the way we schedule power and the way we carry reserves in the system. That's because the amount of electricity being generated must precisely match at all times the amount of electricity being used. As Jason mentioned, Northwest Electric Utilities are building on a 70-year legacy of improving regional coordination and exploring how our region could get access to more choices than we have today and reduce costs for ratepayers. This could serve as a foundation for a within-hour market for non-firm energy called a security-constrained economic dispatch, or what we call SCED. Under a SCED, generation would be drawn from across the broader Northwest market footprint and dispatched every 5 minutes in order of least cost to meet the collective need. This five-minute dispatch will more efficiently resolve imbalance, access a broader range of resources, and capture diversity of loads and generation in a manner that could reduce the total amount of generation held in reserve. There are issues that must be addressed before BPA can decide whether to participate in this type of market, and BPA is holding public workshops on these topics in the coming month. An initial decision is expected to be made in early 2015. We've been able to successfully integrate over 4,500 megawatts of wind energy by building new high-voltage electric transmission lines and adapting to modern-day challenges. By working with our energy partners on coordinated operations across the Northwest, we think we can increase reliability and efficiency that will have even greater benefits for our region. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holtby, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jason Huser, Government Affairs Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm here today to talk about energy, but given the earlier panel this morning, I can't resist doing a little product placement, so have a look. Great water. UAB is Oregon's largest consumer-owned utility. We serve about 90,000 customers, obviously 1 hour south of here. We're unique among Oregon consumer-owned utilities in that we only purchase 50% of our power from the Bonneville Power Administration. We self-supply the other 50%. That primarily comes from three dams on the McKinsey River, but we've added several renewable projects over the past two decades, and I'll be telling you a little bit about those in a moment. UAB has and one more thing. We also operate a wholesale trading floor. We buy and sell electricity. UAB has a long history of triple bottom line decision making, dating back to our pioneering Energy Conservation Department founded in 1977. It was no big stretch for us to take our first foray into renewable energy in 1997 when we acquired a share of a Wyoming wind farm in order to supply energy for our voluntary customer wind power program. It was 2004 when we really ramped up during an update to EWEB's integrated resource plan developed with extensive customer surveys, focus groups, and public stakeholder process. That IRP called for meeting future energy demand with a mix of conservation and renewables. That accounts for several renewable projects in our portfolio today. I'll just run down the list very quickly. Four wind farms, State Line in Umatilla County, Klondike 3 in Sherman County, Harvest Wind in Washington, Foot Creek in Wyoming. All those four projects have a combined rated capacity of 79 megawatts. We also have the Seneca Woody Biomass Project just outside of Eugene at 20 megawatts. Two cogeneration projects, International Paper in Springfield, Wana Paper in Klatskanai, combined 43 megawatts. And finally, 3 megawatts of solar PV. And I list that here because several of those installations, rooftop solar, were incented by programs that EWEB had in place. Not only upfront incentives, but we also, for 10 years, from 2000 to 2010, had a performance incentive, very similar to a feed-in tariff that incented many of those projects to happen. That's a combined 145 megawatts of rated capacity for renewables. For a utility our size, that's quite large. Those purchases fulfilled the 2004 IRP, benefiting EWEB with clean energy, enhanced diversity of our power supply, and you've heard about fuel costs not being present with renewable projects. Somewhere down the road, when those projects are fully amortized, that would be a great benefit, that really just a cost of operating. And finally, these projects together will help EWEB easily comply with the Oregon RPS. One thing that's notable, after we acquired all these projects, the Hynix semiconductor plant, a very, very large industrial load in Eugene, closed down. So in 2011, when we updated our integrated resource plan, there was a realization that we were awash in power. We weren't going to need to build any new generation projects for some time. However, because a lot of our generation we'd acquired was renewable, I talked about the benefits. One thing that the renewables cannot assist us with is planning to meet peak demand. We need a generation that we could flexibly turn on any time to meet peak demand. Our new IRP gave a strong preference to avoid, if possible, using a fossil fuel to meet that peak demand. The logical thing to do would be a natural gas turbine. That's kind of the commonplace way to meet peak demand these days. In our case, our IRP calls for using demand response to meet our peak demand needs in the future. Demand response simply means instead of throttling generation up and down to meet load, which is the historical way of doing things, you actually control the load. You're flipping the script. It's not a new concept. It dates back almost to the invention of electricity itself, but hasn't been executed yet on a grand scale. I'd like to, in closing, I'd like to tell you about a pilot project for demand response that we're engaged in partnership with the Bonneville Power Administration. It's called electric thermal storage. And generally speaking, the idea is that BPA sends us a wind signal telling us that there's wind on the grid at 2 a.m. That's nighttime is often very windy. We have electric water heaters that are equipped with controls and super insulated that can take that signal and know to kick on at 2 a.m. and superheat the water to a scalding temperature of 150 degrees. Because of the insulation, it stays very, very hot for a long time. And then at 6 a.m., as load picks up and people are ready for their day, take showers, microwave their breakfast burrito, et cetera, that hot water is in the hot water heater. There's a mixing valve with cold water on the side that regulates the water to a normal temperature for your normal hot water use around the home. The effect is peak load is reduced, and we've effectively created a primitive battery that is storing that off-peak wind energy as hot water that can be used when it's needed. It's a really neat project. We're hearing really great success stories on it so far. And there's actually a second pilot project, and I don't know as much about it, but I can tell you, generally speaking, it's cold storage. It's just the inverse idea, super freezing something so that it's just the inverse of the hot side. So, in closing, I just wanted to add one more detail. I just purchased a 33 amp hour 12 volt battery and a 30 watt panel, and my next tailgate at Autzen Stadium, I'm going to try to be solar powered with my little 22 inch TV. I'll let you know how it goes. If you see me out there, come by. I'll try to get the battery game on for you. Thank you.
Hanging out with Sean Gillian, he's got a better setup.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon. And unlike EWEB, which was one of the largest, which is the largest consumer-owned utility in the state, we represent some of the smallest. Just to give you a sense of our geographic sweep, and this will come as no surprise to Representative Bentz, we represent Harney Electric Co-op, which is about roughly the size of West Virginia and represents about 2,000 consumers. So we represent a lot of land and not a lot of people, but we are committed, as everybody is on this panel today, to renewable energy. And I just want to talk about some of the things that we're doing on renewables. Our power supplier, primarily 90-95%, is the Bonneville Power Administration. These are from the federal projects on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. We consider these to be the crown jewels of, of the Northwest renewable system, and we invest a lot of money in those projects. We put about $1 billion a year in fish. Investment in that, and those projects are paying dividends. You've probably seen in the press recently that the returns for Fall Chinook, I see Representative Johnson giving a thumbs up. We had 67,000 Fall Chinook cross through Bonneville Dam the other day, which was a record since they started counting. We had an opportunity to take Representative Vega Peterson up there, and she saw some of those big fish. So those investments are paying off, but we have put a lot of resources into that. We have derated the hydro system about 1,000 megawatts. So it's a very important power supply for us, but it's not exclusive for us. We have invested in other things that were on Andy's map. We have put investment into Coffin Butte landfill gas near Corvallis. We have a very exciting geothermal project down in Lake County with Surprise Valley Electric Co-op, 3-megawatt geothermal down there. Very, very important for that community, which is not really shared in the economic recovery. We have a lot of co-ops interested in community solar. Representative Holvey is very familiar with a very exciting partnership between Lane Electric Cooperative and King Estate Winery for the largest solar array of our winery in the Northwest. And that sounds like a good opportunity for a committee field trip, I think, to go take a look at that. So we're doing these things. Renewable programs are working. Jason talked about the net metering programs. I just caution the committee, because you see this every session, that there will be attempts potentially for additional mandates on utilities for net metering programs and telling us what we need to pay, the type of equipment that we can put on for the safety of our alignment. I just caution you to be very skeptical and dubious of those type of proposals, because there is a real potential for cost shifts for senior citizens and low incomes consumers, and those are the folks we really need to be looking after. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Be happy to answer any questions.
Great. I appreciate your testimony, and like I said, maybe we will have a few minutes for questions after the rest of the presenters. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Pacific Corps, Sean Miller and Varner Seaman from Portland General Electric.
This person officially being the PG.
Yeah. Good morning. Sure. Introduce
good morning.
Yourself.
Yeah, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm with Portland General Electric. Thanks very much for taking the time this morning. One of the benefits of kind of being at this point is that I get to kind of hopefully highlight some of the things that other folks said, and I won't go in and kind of repeat what some of the earlier presenters had. So there are a couple things I want to talk about in a little bit more detail. One is Jason Eisdorfer with PC gave a good presentation in terms of where the resource mix exists currently for utilities in terms of both for PGE and for Pacificor in terms of what our renewable resource mix is today. One of the things that we're excited about that doesn't show up in the graph that he had, because that ends in 2012, is the construction that we have going on right now for the Toucannon River project up outside Dayton, Washington, which is it's roughly a 267 megawatt wind farm. Comes in at a cost of about $500 million. It's under construction today. And one of the things that when Portland General Electric looks at the renewable portfolio standard is we have an intention to physically comply with the renewable portfolio standard, to have resources online that are going to match up with what the percentage requirements are for delivering renewable energy. And constructing that project is something that the company is very excited about, and we're happy to have that project coming online so that we can be moving towards physical compliance with that target. And one of the things that is neat about that project is it's a little bit different wind regime than a lot of the wind that's been developed so far in the state. One of the things that people talk about sometimes is with the wind fleet that we have existing in the Columbia Gorge, for folks who've driven up 84 and kind of outside the Arlington area, those projects generally have the same wind regime. With the new Toucannon River project, it has a slightly different profile. And what that means is when the wind blows there, it won't necessarily be blowing in the gorge and vice versa. So you get a little bit better integration benefit and having a little bit flatter shape by having a little bit more diverse set of resource mixes. So we're pretty excited about that project, and we're excited to have that coming online not too far down the road. In addition to the wind that we've got on the fleet, we've got about 60 megawatts of solar between net metering, some of the programs in the VIR, the feed-in tariff that we're talked about, as well as some utility-owned resources. Additionally, we have here in Salem a battery test storage facility, the Salem Test Center, where we're looking at having basically a big battery is existing at the substation, and we're doing some testing of that technology to look at how we can benefit from having storage in our grid as a way to integrate all types of generation that are occurring on our system. And that's a pretty neat project, and I think down the road, if folks on the committee wanted to take some time and go see that project, I think that it potentially also be an interesting one to go look at. The next thing I want to just highlight a little bit when we talk about the integration of renewables, and I want to take a slightly different approach on it. I think a couple folks have talked about the EIM, or the Energy Imbalance Market. It has another, just because acronyms are helpful and not confusing ever. The EIM is often referred to now as a SCED, or Security Constrained Economic Dispatch. I want to step away from sort of the technical description of it for a moment. Not that the acronyms aren't helpful, but one way potentially to think about this, and I think it's maybe one of the wonkiest and also most interesting things happening in energy policy in the Western United States, is it's really an effort to try to create some reforms and some modernization of the way that we buy and sell power. And I think that the way that I think about it sometimes is, as a metaphor, if you think about buying a plane ticket, we don't often these days, if I were to go buy a plane ticket to go visit my mother in Nebraska, I wouldn't pick up a phone and start calling airlines and saying, okay, how much does a ticket cost to fly to Omaha? What I would do is I'd go online and I'd go to probablykayak.com and I would say, I want to fly on Tuesday and come back on Monday or whatever it is to go see my mother. And that would present me with a number of different route options and a number of different prices for different airlines to go take that kind of trip. Essentially what we're doing is we're taking, and the idea behind some of these market reforms is to take 36 separate balancing areas throughout the Western United States and to have that type of electronic modern market function where the different balancing areas can buy and sell power and transmission pathways in real time to keep the grid in balance. And I think that it's one of the types of reforms that, as we look at the evolving electrical system in the Western U.S., is something that's pretty important for getting that type of modernization. I think that most consumers would say that buying airplane tickets online and being able to look at different possible routes and different times and schedules to match up is a benefit to consumers. We think that similarly with an EIM SCED type market reform, we could, and I think the studies are there to show that there is the potential to have a great deal of savings to ratepayers throughout the Western United States. So I think it's a pretty exciting issue to be working on. Our CEO, Jim Pyro, is working on a committee in the Northwest Power Pool that Crystal talked about a little bit, working with Elliot Mainzer, the administrator at BPA, to study the Northwest Power Pool. And we're watching very closely what PacifiCorp and the California ISO are working on and paying pretty close attention to see how those efforts go. So with that, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of PacifiCorp, a multi-state electric investor-owned utility that serves 1.8 million customers in the West and serves approximately 560,000 customers here in Oregon. I passed out a map that will show you, if you open it up, essentially our six states, the Pacific Power States, Washington, Oregon, and California. Our Rocky Mountain states being Montana, Wyoming, and Utah. If you look on the right side of the page, it'll show you our generation facilities and how they are situated within that six-state region that we operate. The company is committed to cost-effectively diversifying our generation. As you heard, we have approximately 10,000 megawatts of company-owned generation. We've currently added 1,700 megawatts of owned wind generation, and in 2012 we added 2 megawatts of solar project in a large solar project in Southern Oregon. And by 2020, the company plans to quadruple its solar capacity. And so we are on track to meet our renewable portfolio standard requirements within Oregon, as well as the other states that we operate. So as for the Oregon RPS, we have exceeded the 2020 mark of 20% already. So just wanted to just touch on some of the challenges and opportunities from PacifiCorp's perspective. As our various states set new energy policies, sometimes these policies create challenges in the way we operate our system. So in the discussion of renewables, it's important that you recognize transmission as we integrate renewables into the grid, as well as don't overlook the importance of our baseload resources, which supply the reliability our customers and our regulators demand. So when you do flick on that switch, the lights come on. For example, as Oregon and other states look at early retirement of baseload generation, this creates a loss of generation which must be replaced with a higher cost new resource. So as cost of replacement generations rise, this is rate pressure on our customers. So furthermore, you know, these uncertainties, like whether it's a federal the federal investment tax credit for renewables, also uncertain is the EPA's final version of 111D, which you've heard a little bit about earlier, to, you know, how that is going to work with our existing power plants under these clean air regulation. We'll be working with our regulators in all six of these states to try to work through that process. And last, some of the opportunities for innovation. And you've heard from Varner as well as the PUC, for example. You know, PacifiCorp has entered into this California, you know, with the California Independent System Operators in this imbalance market. And so the short version, and I won't cover what Varner covers on this, but it is very exciting. We do go live on this next month. It is real-time scheduling or near real-time scheduling of the transmission system, which does allow for more efficient use of the grid, better management of renewables, and saves the utility money by lowering those short-term reserve costs. So, you know, essentially it leverages the geographic diversities of these regions, these different balancing authorities, so regions can share the resources, you know, of ever-changing weather patterns and load demands. And so, you know, in conclusion, you know, as the state considers energy policy next session, you know, we hope that the consideration goes into all the successful programs that the state has created and how that integrates into anything new that you may look at, and then also look at the innovative opportunities that the utilities have provided. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to, you know, answer any questions at the conclusion. Thank you.
Great. Appreciate that. I think we're going to hear from Rachel Shimshack next. And hopefully I said that correctly.
It's kind of lonesome up here now.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Rachel Shimshak. I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Northwest. We are a regional advocacy organization, and our business and nonprofit members work together to promote solar, wind, geothermal, and other renewable resources throughout Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. I wanted to take just a minute today to give you a little bit of context for renewables in the Northwest and specifically in Oregon. Some of the previous speakers mentioned that we really started out in 1997 and 1998 with the first couple of new renewable resource projects to help build on our hydro base and kind of keep our renewable edge. And there were many of the people who you just heard from were the early adopters, and they were people that took the risk and stuck their toe in the water, developed some capability and experience. And you know, when we talk about renewables, size matters, and people always talk about megawatts, and a megawatt of power, a megawatt of wind is enough to serve about 250 customers. And those first two projects that were sponsored by the Bonneville Power Administration, PacifiCorp, PGE, and EWEB, in total amounted to a number in the high two figures. And we've come a long way since then. So that was 1997, 1998. There was another wave of renewable energy development in the Northwest in the 2000-2001 period, and that, as you may remember, the economy was really hot. There was a lot of demand for energy and not enough supply, so people were developing things as quickly as they could. The then treasurer of the state of California, whose name was Phil Angelides, had a good line that I like. He said, at that time, renewables were kind of like high school sex. Everybody was talking about it, but not that many people were doing it. So we did get some good renewable resources out of that wave of development, but I think if you look over the last 5 years, you really see that the renewable resources in the Northwest have really matured. There have been a substantial number of wind projects installed, a lot more solar, some geothermal, and other renewable resources. So now Oregon has over 3,000 megawatts of renewable projects, and that's quite a feat, I would say. So we figured out how to site them properly. We have figured out the transmission to be able to get them from where they're produced to where they're consumed. And customers are benefiting from stabilizing their bills and being able to breathe clean air. That has resulted in $9 billion worth of investment in the state of Oregon. And that's helped both the east side, where the projects normally have been sited, because those counties have really benefited. The local landowners who are sponsoring those projects on their land now have an extra source of revenue. So it's resulted in $110 million of local revenue for counties. That's on the east side of the mountains. On the west side, lots of companies have popped up, and many have their North American headquarters in Oregon, because Oregon has been a really good place to do business, and they're happy to locate here. So it's kind of a good news for the east side, good news for the west side, good for jobs, 5,000 jobs, $9 billion worth of investment, and a lot of clean energy in our supply. There are, however, some challenges ahead of us, and one of the big challenges is that there are a lot of coal plants that are already scheduled for retirement, including our own PGE's Boardman coal plant in Oregon, and it'll be a challenge for the regulators to figure out and public utilities to figure out how to replace that power as those retirements come forward, and that's a challenge for us. Again, we're going to need good good policies to make sure that we get as much clean energy in replacement power as possible so that we can keep our renewable edge. We want to make sure that the transmission system is there. As the other speakers made mention of, we need a lot of flexibility in our system to make sure we can accommodate all these resources. We need cooperation. That's what the EIM is all about. So those are operational changes that make sure that we can move more solar, more wind, more geothermal, more other renewables into the system. And at the end of the day, we also want to make sure that we use energy efficiency, demand response, on-site renewable energy resources, as well as central station resources to work together to give us a reliable, low-cost, low-carbon system that we can be proud of. And it's my hope that Oregon will actually be the leader not only of the West, but for the rest of the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you making the effort to present for us today.
Sure.
As I do all the presenters. And committee, we got about 15 minutes left, and I would like to open up this segment for a few questions. Representative, Vice Chair, Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we call up our both Sean Miller and Barner back up again? I have a question for them, if that would be possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think each of you, I think, referenced the EPA's Section 111 regulations and so forth, and I think they're in the rule writing or rulemaking process right now. I think it's my understanding that they don't foresee that being completed perhaps until maybe 2016. Is that correct? But I guess my question would be maybe twofold. How do you all plan for the future while there's a lot of uncertainty out there about what the future is going to look like for you? And then specifically regarding this committee and what goes on in this building, as you look at the 2015 session, regarding the legislative landscape, obviously, we don't want to be making policies in the dark either, not knowing what ultimately that playing field is going to look like in 2016. So maybe you could just talk about present tense, how you're dealing with this, and future tense looking. What do you need from us going forward that would be helpful for you all as you try to maintain affordability and cost for ratepayers?
Sure. Appreciate that. Again, Varner Seaman, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. So 111D, just to spend a to reorient for a second, is Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. And what we have in front of us right now is a draft rule that came out earlier this year that covers the emissions from the existing power plants. And so essentially a new area of regulation to look at federal carbon emissions from the existing fleet. When we look at the program, it's a pretty long and somewhat complicated rule to understand. There are four areas that are addressed in the draft rule that's in front of us right now. One is improved efficiency from coal plants, improved operating from gas plants, what the federal government thinks folks can do in future renewable energy development, and also additional energy efficiency. So the way that the draft rule is proposed currently is they basically say, okay, we're going to take a year. 2012 is the baseline year, and we're going to use that as a marker. So we look at what we think the emissions were for each state across the country, and then they kind of put those four factors through a formula and say, okay, well, here's your target for 2030 with an interim target in 2020. And for the state of Oregon, it's pretty robust reduction. It's about 48% reduction of emissions in the draft rule from the 2012 level to get to 2030. Which is a pretty significant number. It's actually the fourth most aggressive, on a percentage basis, the fourth most aggressive target within the country. Now, as we look at it, and for Portland General, this is a pretty big issue for us because the way that the rule is designed is it's targeted around the emissions that occur within a state boundary. So for power that's imported to the state, if we're importing power from Montana, while Montana's worrying about its own emissions, it's really only about the generation that occurs in that state. For us, it's a pretty big topic for us. We're actually, we think, partnering pretty well with working with Department of Energy, Public Utilities Commission, Department of Environmental Quality in terms of understanding the rule, for one. We've had what we call spreadsheet parties where some of the analysts are getting together to try to compare the math, make sure folks understand the numbers. There are donuts, so in fact, they are fun parties, maybe. We think we're getting a pretty good understanding in the state about how the rules are designed, and there's some concerns for us right now in terms of how some of the targeting was set. We're not sure how much early compliance is going to count for things like stopping the burning of coal at Boardman by 2020, because that action occurred. The decision was made prior to the rule being drafted. There are some questions about the baseline year. It was actually a pretty high hydro year, so that may make the reduction skewed a little bit because we had a really high water year. We're going to be looking for a little bit more of a rolling average. And there are some interesting things where all the hydroelectric facilities on the border between Oregon and Washington are credited to the state of Oregon, maybe because BPA has a mailing address in Oregon. So there's some things that we have some concerns about in terms of how the target is set. For us, the uncertainty comes in, we don't know until the rule is final, and we expect that to be June of 2015. The federal government said that will be the target date. There may be some litigation that changes what that target date is. But we've got some concern that we don't know if, in the final rule, we don't know if the existing laws we have, and I think Jason Eisdorfer did a good job going through the existing programs we have, and we have a lot of programs that are pretty robust. We didn't necessarily get a whole lot into energy efficiency, but we've got a lot of work going on in that area as well. So we don't know if the business as usual, what we're doing already, is going to get us there. We don't know if we're going to have a stretch goal, and we don't know if the stretch goal is going to be, hey, you need to have more renewables, you need to have more energy efficiency, or different, you know, potential retirement scenarios or the existing fossil fleet that we have. So for us, it's a question of, when we look forward to your question, Representative, towards 2015 and what the legislature should be doing, we've got some concern that if we've got a bucket of sort of available, you know, maybe one way to think of it is bucket of sort of available ratepayer and tax dollar funds to do some additional things on energy, if we apply it to set A of issues, and it turns out when we get the final rule, we really need to be on B, we're concerned that we don't necessarily want to make a bunch of new obligations and have it go towards the wrong area, if that makes sense, because we're going to have to comply with the federal rule, and we're really not going to know until at least June of 2015 in terms of what that is. So it's a little bit of a moving target. So we're not real excited about having a whole lot of new programs or new requirements on us until we really know kind of where what we have to do to match up with that federal expectation.
We just leave them alone for a year.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, I think we would agree, PacifiCorps would agree with that perspective that, you know, not knowing what the final rule is until essentially almost after the next legislature concludes, it will be difficult for us to kind of take on different policies in this area. And so, you know, I think during next session we'll be watching how this develops very closely. I know probably in your committee. But if you look at, how this affects PacifiCorps in particular, again, going back to our six states, looking at where our coal facilities are, which are in our Rocky Mountain states, in Utah, if you look at that map, quite different than when you look at the portfolio in our Pacific Power states. And so how that affects the Pacific Power states, we're working through that. And so we don't know the answer to that. But if you do look at those coal facilities that are online now, they all fully depreciate by 2033. So at that point, in our integrated resource plans, we'll be moving to different base, load generation at that point. So the question is how these different policies affect early retirement, which, again, I think puts pressure, rate pressure onto our customers. And so that's how we need to look at all these policies. We don't know yet how this will affect that. But, again, knowing that 2033 date when all those coal facilities retire, it's a question, if you look at coal and regulating carbon, at that point, we have pretty much taken care of that on ourselves, basically by our own planning. It's how soon you want to get there, and that's what the rate pressure that we'll be concerned with for our customers.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, you hit the target with the question. It was one of the reasons we wanted to focus today on renewables, because the implication is if we're retiring that coal, what are we going to replace that baseload generation with? And I'd actually like the PUC and perhaps Crystal Ball to come up and talk about 111D and what they see as the implications, if they care to comment on it, just from the agency or regulator point of view. Trick question.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Jason Eisdorfer with the Public Utility Commission. Currently, the staff of the PUC, the DEQ, and Department of Energy have been meeting. I think, as Varner said, the first step is to understand what the 111D rule looks like now, and frankly, I think as Representative Johnson is indicating, it may change between now and the final rule. So we're going through spreadsheets trying to figure out what compliance might look like. Because Boardman, so I think Varner earlier mentioned that there are basically four primary buckets. There's efficiency at a coal plant. There's redispatching a coal plant to gas facilities. There's renewable energy, and there's energy efficiency. Because Boardman is scheduled to shut down in 2020, that efficiency at the coal plant is not a tool we can use, because that is the only coal plant in the state. It does, however, the closure of Boardman does actually get us a chunk of the way toward the goal. So it really then becomes a matter of how would we comply using renewable energy, energy efficiency. Do we have the right policies in place now to get there? Do we need to ramp up? So I suppose the answer to the question, Representative Holy, is that we have a bunch of additional questions. So we're continuing to try to work this through. It's going to be a process. I really do think that the EPA itself is in a listening mode. They know that every state that they created a budget for has a series of their own unique issues. One of the unique issues, I think, is in the Northwest is the federal system, the hydro system, how variable it can be from year to year. We can have really good water years, and we can have really bad water years, and depending upon which one it is, you have more or less emissions from your fossil fuel generation. If it's a great water year, you dispatch your fossil fuel generation less, and vice versa. So there are some things that are unique about the Northwest that the EPA hasn't quite grasped. But for the most part, I think we're still very much in a investigative stage.
Okay. Chair Holby, members of the committee, the Bonneville Power Administration is part of the U.S. federal government, and we support the administration's policies. But we are very interested in working with our four Northwest states where we serve utility customers and understanding the concerns about the EPA's proposal. In fact, I arranged with Jason to have the Oregon team meet with the BPA team just last week so that we could talk about those concerns. And we are very interested in helping educate the EPA about the federal system and the Northwest's unique characteristics.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've talked to a few of the stakeholders and agencies as far as the implications to the state of Oregon as a government in trying to comply with this, and certainly it involves all the utilities and stakeholders that are involved in energy generation. And so as far as looking at those policies that may need to change and all that, I know we probably won't broach those subjects too much in 2015, but had put out that there may be interest in establishing a large task force of all the stakeholders to sit around and start planning for those eventual impacts that that clean air and greenhouse gas emissions standards may impose on Oregon. So thank you very much. Representative Leininger, another question.
Thank you. You know, I just wanted to thank the people in the room and Chair Holby for convening this particular mix of folks on the energy issues. It seems like how we deal with having clean, affordable, dependable energy supply, you know, going into the future as we think about climate change, as we think about affordability issues and off, you know, kind of retiring old generation facilities here and elsewhere, that's going to have a huge impact on our economic opportunity, on our environmental health, and it's one of the most dynamic, interesting policy areas in the state and in the country, and, you know, we're in a position to work collaboratively on it, and I'm excited about what we can do together in the coming 5-10 years. So thanks for this great information, and thanks for convening it.
Any other questions or comments?
Representative Whitson. I have one for Rachel. I see your forms you've done here with the renewables. I was wondering if you could provide for this committee a breakdown by renewable source, the total subsidies paid by consumers and Oregon taxpayers to develop this $9.2 billion in renewables, including Betsy's, tax credits, everything that you have, so we can see what the offset is that our ratepayers have paid to achieve this and our taxpayers. And if you could provide that to the committee, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, thank you for the question. I guess I would begin by saying that every source of energy that we consume, whether it's coal, gas, nuclear, or renewables, is affected by public policy on the federal level and on the state level, and there are subsidies for all of them. I am not equipped at this instant to tell you precisely how much federal or how much state support has gone. Perhaps the Office of Energy can help provide that, but I will say that it couldn't come close to $9 billion worth of investment in the state of Oregon, and the 5,000 jobs that have resulted and the economic vitality that has come to the local communities that have been able to benefit from these investments and the services that that investment has helped pay for in terms of fire protection, new roads, programs at schools, and the like that probably would not have been available if these projects had not been able to go forward. So there, the state has certainly risked some money in order to make these renewable energy resources available, but I think what the state has gotten back in economic development, in clean air, and in jobs has been worth it.
If you could provide that for us, that would be great. I'm sure you can get somebody to help you add all of that together and break it out for us. That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. If I could just respond to the previous set of questions about 111D. I guess I would say that the state is in a good position and has been in a leadership position on clean energy and renewables, and I hope that the state continues to keep that position. Moving forward on renewables with additional policy to give utilities confidence that if they go forward and invest, that that'll be a good thing and that there'll be support for that, won't be a mistake. Renewables are good for the long term. It's like buying a 30-year mortgage. You know, you know that the cost you sign up for on day one is going to be the same cost for the 30-year life of the resource. And you really can't say that about many other resources. There are other costs and risks involved. So it's a good bet, both for energy efficiency and renewables, and I hope you'll entertain policy suggestions as the session goes forward.
Thank you. Another question?
Nope. That's, there's two questions on there. Four. You
okay.
Ask us to submit questions.
All right. Thank you very much. And we're right exactly 15 seconds over our time limit. So thank you all for your attention and providing us your thoughts.
Mr. Chair,
thoughts.
If I could real quick, our last chair would always get us out of here like an hour early.
I'll keep that in mind. You're always welcome to leave at any time. With that, I will adjourn the Interim House Committee on Energy and Environment. Energy and Environment.